Hello, everyone. Welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's May 25th of 2016, and we are here to be talking about manga. Chris is here. Rolo-T, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, mostly. I'm a little bit kind of tired.
Tired? Do you need me to re-energize you? Perhaps we could do, like, some cross-country, like, fusion ha dance? Sync our power levels together? I don't know how the whole dance goes. There, we were pretty much on cue.
We totally synced up.
If you account Skype lag, we'd be fucking the Chris right now. Or Nris? Crick? Crick doesn't sound good. Nris, I guess, is a little bit better. Yeah, we'll go with Nris.
Why don't we just go Nikris?
That doesn't seem like a fusion of our names. It feels like we couldn't figure it out, so we just combined as much of them as we could without just being like Nick hyphen Chris
exactly
is my name. Alright, well, you know what? Maybe that works its own way. I've had a couple people asking me about something, Nick, because I don't know if you've heard, there's a controversy in the world right now.
Which controversy is that?
A Captain America controversy.
I have heard about
There's
that.
Technically two. I'll only talk about one this week. And that is that I guess there's a new Captain America series running or about to start. You know, shockingly, they couldn't keep Captain America, white Captain America, from being Captain America forever, you know, so there's going to be two now. But I guess the plot synopsis or spoilers came out from the first issue, and supposedly Captain America's revealed to have always been like a Nazi sleeper agent and has always been a racist, homophobic, you know, white supremacist shithead.
Playing the long game with him.
Yeah, it's like 70 years of him fighting for truth, justice in the American way, and finally he's like, now's my time to strike as a shithead.
There's no possible way that this could not be some sort of, like, red herring, or there's some sort of additional twist to the story. If you're like, no! Clearly, he's a Hydra agent.
Clearly. And people will ask me, like, what's your thoughts on this? Because it's crazy. Because I'm a big Captain America fan. He's, like, right back there. You know, I love this guy. My thought is, I don't care. Because this is the comic books. And the comic books are fucking stupid. I lost my ability to care about things that happen in comic books after I found out what happened at the end of the comic book version of Civil War, which was that Captain America was shot and killed through the head. But because he came back, they needed a way to write around the fact that he got sniped through the head. So instead of being sniped through the head, he was sniped with a magical time displacement bullet that trapped his essence in a time and place. And even though his body was alive, it could then be brought back once his essence was returned to it. But of course, Red Skull took over his body first, and they had to chase him out. And I'm like, that's so stupid. I can't understand why people read comics. Thank God they started making movies, because it sounds so ridiculous every time I try to look at the comics.
Well, there was also the thing where Dr. Octopus and Spider-Man switched bodies at one point.
And Superior.
So Peter Parker experienced the memory of Dr. Octopus having sex with his Aunt May.
Oh, that's so gross.
It's like, comic books!
Yeah, so, shockingly, Captain America being a Nazi death cultist doesn't bother me very much, because at this point, the comics can do anything
for him. Hashtag, not my Captain America.
Yeah, I'm like, look, did Chris Evans do it? Is Chris Evans a Nazi? No? Then I think I'm okay with my fandom at this point.
Even if Chris Evans actually is a Nazi, so long as Chris Evans Captain America is
Yeah, you know what? Let's separate actor and person here. Chris Evans, if he wants to be white supremacist, that's fine. Just on screen, you're about all colors and creeds.
Anyway.
A little off topic there to start with, but you know, what else are we going to do?
It's Weekly Manga Recap. We wouldn't be true to ourselves if we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Now, well, let's start off by talking about the suggestion we took for this week, which is something that I've been looking forward to for some time, ever since basically we decided we were going to do this in addition to JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, interspersed throughout the year, which is Pokemon Adventures, also known as Pokemon Special.
Yes.
Basically, this is a very, very, very long-running manga series that is based on the Pokemon games, has actually technically been running longer than the Pokemon anime.
I meant to look that up to see which one ran first. I had to assume the manga came before it, though. if only for the fact that the first episode of the anime featured Ho-Ho in it. And I was like, that probably came out closer to Gold and Silver coming out.
Well, they both came out in 1997.
Oh, okay.
Started. Apparently, the manga started in March, and the anime started April 1st. So, not a whole lot of difference.
Yeah, they're right on top of each other.
So, the manga has been running longer, and I believe doesn't have as many additions to it. Like, I don't think that it's... I don't think it's a weekly series.
It was monthly from the part I was reading it. Because they make mention of that, the creator does, and some of his, like, endgame stuff a couple times. So, I assume it was always monthly, because I'm not sure what magazine it runs in.
Well, let's see here, because... Yeah, I think that it is monthly. I want to say it is. A lot of it is actually available in English through Viz translations. Not all of it, though.
Yes, you can. They actually have these pretty sweet box packs that you can get if you're interested that are actually really well priced, because you can just take a look at one volume and, like, has the you know, price on the back of originally being $10 a pop, but I got this whole thing for like $30.
Oh,
so
sweet.
You can get a real good deal. And this covers all of up to Gold and Silver. And they have this for, I think, all of the parts they've translated thus far. There's a box set for them, because I think I saw at least up to Diamond and Pearl.
They, last I checked was, the latest volume available in English is, the end of Black and White. It doesn't cover Black 2 and White 2, or Hard Gold, Soul Silver, and English volumes are, like, a year behind Japanese volumes.
Yeah.
So not quite, you know, your standard, like, shonen manga, available almost as soon as it's available in Japan, but doing pretty, at a pretty good pace. And apparently, like, the manga is, like, runs basically, in accordance with what game is current. So X and Y is what's running in the magazine right now.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, anyway. Apparently, Annalisa is saying that they have done Heart Gold and Soul Silver, because that would have been Diamond and Pearl. That would have been Gen 4.
Oh, yeah. So. Anyway. For those of you who don't know what Pokemon is,
you can just not bother reading this series, because this does not cater to you. You know, like, every other piece, like, even, I think, the Pokemon movie still had, like, a brief blurb to explain what Pokemon are. I feel like there's
nothing.
There
are these monsters, and people throw balls at them to catch them, and they train with them to fight against each other, and they're very cute, but super powerful.
There's no leeway given in this series. It assumes not only are you a fan, you know all the terms, because it doesn't even bother to explain half the shit in it.
Capture, evolution...
You're like, what's a gym leader? You'll figure that out, or you already know.
It is definitely something that's like, hey, here's a manga that is kind of like an interpretation of the journey you go on through the games. Much more closer to the games, I would say, than the anime is, actually. At least to an extent. There are definitely certain characters that fill roles that you wouldn't associate from encountering them in the games. Like, did you know that Lieutenant Surge and Sabrina are evil?
Yeah.
Well, they are.
Well, it's a series that has, like, a plot to it, you know. I mean, there's a plot to the Pokemon anime, and there's a plot to every game, even though, you know, until Ruby and Sapphire, they're pretty bare bones with it. There's still, like, a more serious sort of narrative going on in even Pokemon Adventure Red and Blue, or Red and Green, whatever it gets called. But it is sort of strange. Like the Pokemon anime, it diverts itself completely from the games. You know, it doesn't have to follow every single mechanic. Pokemon can know more than 4 moves, things like that. But it's weird that some things it ties itself very closely into. Like, there's a very meta moment that was bizarre for me, where, and I guess actually we should get this out of the way, the Gary character, what do you call him?
I call him Green.
Okay, I call him Blue because I read the English translation, so it catered off the games. I'm just going to call him Gary for the sake of this. Where Gary mentions to Ash, essentially, you should get the Boulder Badge, because the Boulder Badge increases the attack of your Pokemon. I was like, that's fucking weird. Like, it's such a meta concept that it, like, having this trinket raises the stats of all of your Pokemon somehow without having any contact with them. But then there are other things that it does that don't follow anything from the games at all. Like, sure, I have, like, six Pokemon out at once, and they can team up and beat each other up and attack the trainers. Whatever. And I'm like, I want to divorce myself from the fact that I'm thinking of the game mechanics and trying to, like, enjoy a new medium. But it's weird because there's a lot of little callbacks to the games as well. Like, every time they look into Pokedex, they're like, our health is low. It's like a shot from the game itself. And, you know, like, if they look up Pokedex entries, it's literally the Pokedex entries from the game. And they even fucking, once it gets to yellow, find a way to squeeze in a little Pikachu emotion thing into the mangas. It's trippy as shit.
And, you know, they make reference to the Pokemon's level. There's a moment where they introduce that the Pokedex has a cancel button for evolution. So, like, when you're playing through the game and you don't want your Pokemon to evolve, you hit B. There's a cancel button. So you can do the exact same thing in the manga. It's very much... The manga is an interpretation specifically of the game. Definitely. It takes a lot of the mechanics and stuff, but also it does have a lot of flexibility. It's an interpretation of what combat is like what the combat in the game kind of represents, I guess. And, of course, it doesn't strictly adhere to the rules of the game. Like, there are moments, just like in the anime, where Pikachu manages to beat some ground-type Pokemon.
Yeah.
Through really weird, unorthodox use of its electric powers. There's literally a moment where Red, the protagonist, gets three of his Pokemon to create a Thundercloud and a Lightning Rod.
Yeah. And again, that was like, and that was in the Pokemon League. That's where it's like, holy shit, this is weird. Because he's just straight up using two Pokemon at once to beat Gary. And I'm like, this is fucking me. This is freaking me out, man. Why isn't a ref calling this?
It's going to be very difficult to discuss the first part of the series because, well, and eventually they also make reappearances. I should start off, the protagonist is Red.
Yes.
He's the Ash equivalent character. His rival in the original Japanese was called Green.
Because that's what the games were over there, Red version and Green version.
But Green version didn't make it over to the States. Well, let's see, the Blue version came over.
Yeah, there was a Red, Green, and Blue version in Japan, but Red and Green were like the first ones. Only and Red Green. And Blue came over to the States, so they called the characters off that naming convention. But there was still a third character, so in the Japan, she was called Blue, since that was the third game. But here, there was no Blue, or Green, rather, so they just give her Green and basically switch the names of those characters.
So, I started reading the series when he was called Green. So, I'm going to try and make an effort to not call him that, though, because it's going to be, I think, easier for the big majority of our audience for me to call him Blue, because that's, like, the rival character in the games, it's called.
I think it helps tremendously that their characters are two different genders, so any immediate pronouns will kind of establish who we're talking about, since it's a confusion.
So, if you've never played a Pokemon game, you're going to have no idea what the hell's going on in this. But if you are at least somewhat familiar with Pokemon, basically the story focuses on Red going on his Pokemon journey, encountering new Pokemon, capturing them, bonding with them, training them to get stronger, facing off against foes and battling them, and trying to become the champion of the region. By proving that he's the best trainer. And he encounters these gym leaders at certain different points along his journey, and they pose basically incremental challenges against him. There's also the evil Team Rocket. There are no Jesse or James or Meowth in this series because it's based directly on the games. And not Pokemon Yellow. That comes later.
They still have Jesse and James, though.
Still don't have Jesse James in that one, though. So, it's just like, you know, It's actually in place of Team Rocket, several of the gym leaders are just evil.
Yeah, it's actually basically like split halfway down of the Kanto gym leaders. Four of them are good guys, four of them are bad guys.
So you've got Brock and Misty, which if you've only seen the anime, you might be wondering, why aren't they just going with Ren his journey? It's because that's not what they did in the games.
Yeah, that's the anime thing.
Erica and Blaine are the other two good gym leaders. Blaine is actually probably the single most important gym leader, like, in the entire series. Like, full stop.
Oh, have even, like, future parts and things like that?
As far as I remember.
Okay.
Because, at the very least, he is definitely the most important gym leader, aside from... No, even including Giovanni in the first part. I think that Giovanni overtakes him in the second part, I think. But and of course, spoilers, Blue eventually becomes a gym leader too. So he kind of counts.
But yeah, I mean, of the eight original gym leaders, you could say being put into the series, Blaine probably gets the most screen time collectively since he actually has, like, a full character arc to go with, and his whole story is tied very closely then with Mewtwo's, and Mewtwo becomes a significant character.
Team Rocket in general.
Yeah, so he's probably the one who gets in there the most, which was pretty cool for me, because I was a big Blaine fan, and I was like, oh, thank God he's not evil.
He's a really cool interpretation of Blaine, too. He looks like, you know, the game version with a big old mustache, as opposed to weird hippie guy in the anime. Do you remember Blaine from the anime? Those were some badass episodes, but Blaine was weird. He wore a wig and stupid sunglasses, and he didn't have a mustache.
Well, I remember what's sort of weird is... And actually, it's a funny scene in the manga. There comes a point where a later character goes to visit him in his gym, or like where he's training, and they just see this person like dodging fireballs to work with Mewtwo, and they're like, who is this? And they follow him back to his gym, and he like... pulls off a wig and then puts on a fake mustache, and they're like, holy shit, it's Blaine. He's like, yes, it's me, I needed a disguise. Also, I burned off my real mustache years ago in fire training. I don't know why I just find it so funny that his like most trademark facial feature was just fake the entire time.
Yeah, I would wear a fake mustache if mine burned off too.
Yeah.
I think we're kind of getting a little bit ahead of ourselves talking about Blaine first of all. What did you think of Red, though? Because I think that a lot of times I've seen people who are, like, you know, really hardcore fans of the manga talk about, like, what an awesome upgrade Red is from Ash. But I think that they kind of neglect how many similarities he actually has with Ash, at least early on.
Yeah, I mean, they're both kind of douchey, annoying kids at the start of it. Like, they're both kind of whiny, they're both kind of annoying, they both have kind of a... not a bad attitude, but just sort of an arrogance to them that's kind of annoying, like an entitlement. Like, anytime Gary shows up Blue and he's doing things, he immediately gets jealous and is like, oh, I wish, you know, that, you know, why does everybody care about that guy so much? It's not to the same extent Ash does in the anime, because Ash is, like, legitimately just a butt monkey to Gary's awesomeness throughout, like, the first part of Kanto. But Red still has kind of annoying traits to him early on. Enough, not enough that you're like, he's actually detestable or anything like that. Enough that you're like, okay, he's a 10-year-old kid who has Pokemon and is going on a journey. I can understand that, and he gets better with time. I think for Red in this series, it's hard for me to really say too much about him because he kind of gets eclipsed by his other two protagonists. Like, he doesn't have the cool factor that Blue has, you know, that Gary Oak, I'm Gary motherfucking Oak kind of style.
Oh, no, hold on a second. I'm going to stop you right there. Blue is definitely, like, the Sasuke character in this series. He literally, like, in the second half of the Gen 1 series, just shows up, and whenever he shows up, he's riding on a Pokemon, standing perfectly still, straight up. He's got a cloak cast over his shoulders. He's, you know, looking contemplative as he rides across the water.
That's fucking pimp, though. I mean,
He's totally awesome in a completely...
It's a different
actually
way.
Actually cool way, as opposed to Gary motherfucking Oak, who shows up in a top-down convertible with a harem cheering him on.
That's fucking... That's also super pimp.
That motherfucker earned 10 gym badges in one region, not including the Volcano and Earth badge. He found 4 gyms that don't exist.
They made such a big deal about Sabrina having, like, the unstoppable psychic Pokemon. Gary fucking curb stomped her, like, 6 months ago, and she's just trying to get over it.
He probably should have been like, I'm Gary Oak, and she was like, oh.
And she's like, oh, you're so cute, have this gym badge. And you're like, hey, still earned that more than half of Ash did, so. Ash just made her laugh.
Ash just had a fucking hilarious haunter. He still got curb stomped in their second battle.
But no, like, Blue's just got, like, a cooler kind of ambiance and style to him, and Green just has a lot more personality. So, for Red, at the start, he's kind of just the protagonist we follow, but he gets better towards the end of it. He does kind of embody that legendary coolness that, you know, Red, the character in the games, gets when you face him in part, when you face him in Gold and Silver. Like, that just, like, legendary tier person who just hangs out in Mount Moon. He has that kind of charisma and attitude and sway to him.
And that's what's interesting about the series is that you'll find this later on, like, because by the time you get to the yellow part, they actually make a whole ton of references to the fact that 2 years have passed since the start of the first one. Mm-hmm. And the characters actually do age over time. And in fact, I looked this up, in the most recent appearance that Red, Blue, and Green make, they're all 20 years old.
Damn.
Which is really weird to think about Pokemon protagonists being that old. But they actually age and mature over the course of the series. And that's actually, I think, the thing that makes Red a cool character, is you see him start off as Ash Ketchum, basically, and mature and become this, like you said, kind of legendary figure over the course of the whole series, not just one part, but every time you see him and he makes a new appearance, he's aged and he's matured and he's that much cooler. Mm. And the way that people also, you know, react to him also changes over time, and he influences a lot of people by being this very not mentor, but idol type of figure for a lot of people. A lot of people idolize him and try to live up to the example that he sets by being the first big Pokemon hero, basically. Lost my train of thought.
What helps too for him is, you know, because people will compare him to Ash, as you said, but the issue Ash always had is that, you know, he's the lead character in anime that's been running for, what, like 15 plus years, that is not going to change a lead character, is not going to make him older, and isn't really going to give him a full character arc. So, where Ash will always kind of still be the same sort of person, just maybe a little bit more mature, you can actually get, like, a real change out of Red and see him develop and have, see what he becomes after he stops being kind of that annoying person.
And then we have Blue, who is much cooler than Blue in the games, honestly. Because Blue in the games is a whiny dick.
Blue in the games is a shit. You fucking hate him. He spends the entirety of the games being just one step ahead of you and shitting on you, despite the fact you beat him every time. Like, he's always just like, oh, I lost. Whatever. I already got the HM cut. I'm out of here. Later. Like, you fucking... Oh. Gary! I mean, I love Gary in the games for that very reason, but yeah, in this he actually does feel like the rival who's one step ahead of Red throughout the series, just because he always seems to know what's happening before Red does.
I'm the champion now, Red. You can never hope to beat me. I beat you 5 times over the course of my journey.
I beat you coming into this building. Whatever!
That's why you have a Jolteon, is because I beat you those 2 battles that determine what type it turns out to as. And then they're about, let's see, a third or so of the way through the first part of the series, we introduce Green, who is the female protagonist. And I think that she's, like, actually the first ever appearance of, like, a female protagonist in, like, the Pokemon franchise. I want to say that
it would have came out before Crystal did, which was the first time, the first female character. And then I don't know what you consider a female protagonist in the anime, but it's always basically been Ash. So,
and Green's a very different type of character from the other two, because she is established to be a very skilled Pokemon trainer, but she's this very mischievous trickster sort. Her main goal is to, at least as it was presented early on, is just to trick people and scam them out of their money. And so, you know, Red and Green will, Red and Blue rather, are, you know, will be glaring at each other and be like, you know, trying to one up each other. And then Green comes along and it's just like, "Hi, boys!" You know, and will, you know, use her charm. And, you know, there's literally a panel where she, where she's trying to, you know, fake cry, and she like dabs her eyes with fake tears so that she can actually, so that she can be like, "Oh, please help me!" You know. And she's a very fast talking sort of character. Which then plays into the way that she actually conducts her battles, which is to use a lot of tricks and deceit, including one unforgettable moment for me where her entire body is paralyzed, so she tricks Sabrina into slashing open her top to reveal that her giant breasts are actually Pokeballs, so she can release Pokemon and have them attack.
Shockingly, that scene didn't make it into the English translation. I knew of its legendary status, but it's under. But she is like a trickster, essentially, like a very conniving person. And that, as you said, it plays into her battle. She has a very unique style of battling. Like, she has a good, big, strong powerhouse in Blastoise, but then, like, her biggest primary Pokemon after that is a Ditto, which she uses for trickery. Like, she'll make people think it's her Blastoise, and in actuality, it's her Ditto. Or she'll use her Ditto to transform into things like keys, or, you know, something that she'll use for a trick. Like, "Oh, you thought that was my Pokeball, but actually, that's a Ditto. Fuck you. I got you." Like, it, she's sort of, almost like that, like an Usopp-type character, something like that, where every battle is kind of like a layer of strategies that they're working through to kind of get to. And I think that made her fights more fun and memorable for me, because she has a more limited team, too. Like, I think she has a full six Pokemon.
She's got a lot of normal types.
Yeah, but she doesn't have, she doesn't use them at the same frequency that characters like Red and Blue do, so it makes her battles a lot more fun and unique. And she does have a story to her, like a little bit of an arc that kind of defines why she is the way she is.
Plus, she uses Blastoise as a jetpack.
Yeah, she does that a lot, which is, again, it's crazy for me to be like, "What's happening here?"
Blastoise can't fly.
But I liked Green probably most of anybody from the these protagonists in this part.
And what did you think of Giovanni in the series? Because he ends up being the main villain, and, you know, because he's the leader of Team Rocket. And in the first part, he doesn't really get to do a whole lot, because he's, you know, the guy who lurks in the shadows and he only reveals himself really at the very end. He meets Red early on, and thinks about taking him out then, but Red kind of impresses him with the way that he acts, and so he's like,
actually, go. He doesn't impress him, he reveals a weakness. He reveals that he cares too much about Pokemon, and he won't let a Pokemon die if it means winning a battle or something like that. So he's like, "I don't need to take him out now, because I can always exploit that weakness later on." Which is actually kind of a cool moment in a way. But ultimately, Giovanni in the manga is a lot like Giovanni in the game. He's sort of a dark, imposing figure, but once you get down to it, his plan really doesn't have any logic to it, doesn't seem to accomplish anything, and you just beat him up at one point in a big battle, and that's it.
Although, so, I mean, although the battle that he has with Red is my favorite in the arc, pretty damn easily.
Is that the one that's like a Machamp versus Poliwrath, I think?
No,
never mind. I'm thinking the Gary or the Blue versus Red match is that. Well, that's pretty sweet.
Basically, what happens is, because Red has previously encountered Lieutenant Surge, and there's this ridiculous thing that Surge has managed to do, which is, he has all this ridiculous equipment powered by Zapdos. So he's, like, got a Zapdos-powered force field, and there's all this electricity running around him. So all of his clothing is, you know, rubber, basically. So it won't conduct electricity. And Red manages to beat him, and then he takes his gloves, just in case. And that's where he gets the trademark fingerless gloves that Red and Ash wear. And then later on, Red fights against Giovanni, and Giovanni drives him completely into a corner. He's beaten a bunch of his Pokemon. He's damaged most of Red's other Pokeballs so that he can't release the Pokemon inside them to keep fighting him. And the only one option he's got left is his Pikachu. And he's like, look, I know what you're planning on doing. You're going to unleash your Pikachu and you're going to use it to attack me. But I can tell you how this is going to go. In the time that you are going to release Pikachu, have it charge an attack, and then have it unleash it, I will react to it, and I will, you know, knock it out, and I'll beat you. But what he doesn't count on is Red has Pikachu charge his attack inside the Pokeball, and then he unleashes and has it attack immediately, and he wins that way. And he's like, well, how the hell did you hold a Pokeball that had a Pikachu charging electricity inside it? And he's like, well, I got rubber gloves from your lieutenant.
Fuck you.
It's like, ah!
It are cool moments like that. It's just, it was a little hard to get over, like, and for some reason, gym badges in this game are, like, mythical objects of power, despite the fact, presumably, they're still handed out regularly. So there's, like, a whole fucking, like, keystone. It's like Shindu in the first season of Jackie Chan Adventure. You have to put all the talismans in him, and something amazing's gonna happen. And you're just like, I don't get what the purpose of this is. I think it was mostly just to make this weird Zapdos Moltres Articuno monster that really didn't go anywhere.
Not sure how they managed to do that, honestly.
It's a weird thing. Like, it's cool in its own way, but it's not like, it's sort of the same thing the games has, where you understand what Team Rocket's gimmick and goal is, you just don't understand how this accomplishes anything. Like, if you already had three legendary birds under your power, if your whole thing was just to steal more Pokemon, I feel like you could have done it with just those three already. Like, I don't know what fusing them to one monster hybrid thing really does.
Just take a moment to note that this is still a manga that is oriented towards little kids. Or at least originally I know it ran in a Kodomo manga magazine. So it was oriented towards, you know, like elementary school age kids, which makes certain more gruesome moments rather perplexing, like a moment where an Arbok gets its head cut off.
Now, I've seen that image before, because a lot of people, when they talk about this, will bring up that scene. They'll talk about how it's like Pokemon fucking die in this series. And that's the shot you see. That Arbok doesn't die, though. That Arbok, for some reason, and this is another thing that's just weird as shit as me, there's like magic Pokemon. Like Pokemon who just have new things they can do. So that Arbok can literally regenerate as long as its head's still intact. So that Arbok we see later on is fine. It's vile in that moment, and you go a while before you know that Arbok's fine. But it is a little misleading, I think, for people to say, like, there's a lot of death and violence in this series. I noticed a couple times where it definitely seems like that Pokemon probably didn't survive, but
there was one moment where a ghost Pokemon controlled the corpses of a bunch of dead Pokemon, and
yeah, don't get me wrong. It's still darker than you'd expect, but it's not obscenely black kind of dark or anything like that. It actually kind of lightens up more and more as the series goes on, because I think you get less and less of those moments where, like, did he just shatter that ice, that Pokemon who was frozen solid, and kill it? I think he did. I don't think that Electabuzz is getting back up.
Yeah, Giovanni is pretty hardcore. Like, there's a moment where Red, basically the moment where Red and Giovanni encounter each other, Red spares some Magmar that had set a building on fire. He knocks them out, but he, you know, is just like, oh, you know, they're done now. And Giovanni is like, he's too merciful. He summons a Cloyster and freezes the Magmar and then shatters their frozen bodies.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus, dude!
It's kind of metal.
Speaking of Jesus, Yellow.
Alright, so I made a tweet a little bit ago that was to the extent of, does Yellow ever stop being insufferable? And I had quite a few people say, like, I can't believe you think that, including Annalisa, who's in our chat, who was, you know, like, how dare you? Yellow's my daughter. Don't ever talk bad about her. Spoilers, it's her. I don't know why that's, like, a hidden thing, though. Like, because the first time you see her, she has a ponytail.
Let's put it this way. Again, series for little kids.
I get it, but I was like,
When you are given the explanation of, oh, it's a blonde-haired kid who is familiar with Red and is from Viridian City. Gee, there was a girl that Red encountered in Viridian City.
Yeah, like, it's like she wore the same clothes. You saw the hair back then. I knew the twist going into it, but I was like, Ian Reed, I was like, I think he knew this, whatever. So, spoilers, it's a her. My issue with Yellow is that Because essentially, as you said, there's like, I think, four volumes? Maybe it's only three volumes. Basically encompass the red slash blue part of the series. And then the rest of it continue on with it, but Yellow becomes the protagonist. So then it's Pokemon Yellow, essentially, that's covering, which doesn't follow the plot at all, but Yellow becomes the protagonist. Yellow gets introduced, and immediately kind of comes off a little bit Mary Sue-ish, because she comes into the series kind of out of nowhere, and is like, oh, Ash is Pikachu, Red's Pikachu, that was kind of very hostile to him, and it took him time and trust to, you know, a form relationship with. We're cool already. And also, I can talk and communicate with Pokemon. Also, I can magically heal them telepathically. Also, I don't fight Pokemon to capture them or anything like that. I like them to be just the way they are, friends. And you're like, all right, fucking shut up, Wesley. I get it. Like, she gets better. And she's not, like, a perfect, like, you know, the Mary Sue kind of archetype. But she just has those qualities that once it gets introduced to you at once, you're like, this is just annoying to me right now. That's my thought process on her initially. I lightened my opinion of her by the end. But she has an annoying first impression to me.
And I don't really care much for Yellow, honestly.
No, I still don't like her by the end of it.
I don't dislike her, I just don't care for her nearly as much as, like the initial three protagonists, I think, are all really strong characters. And they have a good balance between them. And Yellow's thing, her defining quality is that she is kind. She is absurdly kind to Pokemon. She can communicate psychically with them, which is a little bit weird, but that's the entire, like, theme of her arc, because it turns out that she's not the only one who can do that.
Yeah.
And the same power allows her to heal Pokemon. She's a freaking walking Pokemon Center. And so she just kind of instantly gets along with people, and the thing that really bugged me going through it the second time that I completely forgot about is that the entire premise of the second arc is that Red has been kidnapped. He's gone missing. And Yellow learns about this and goes to find him, because Red had encountered her at one point on his journey and left a deep impression on her. In fact, a running theme through Pokemon Adventures is the fact that Yellow is in love with Red. But can't really bring herself to do anything about it. In fact, at the end of the arc, Red is like the only person who doesn't know that Yellow's a girl.
Yeah.
Literally everyone else has figured it out or has had the secret revealed to them in some way.
There's literally a point where he makes a joke about, like, oh, well, Pikachu really likes you. I guess we'll just have to all live together. Ha 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 ha. And she's Yellow's like, ah. She's like, oh, senpai! No, it's me!
Suppose it's me! Doki Doki! But she shows up to Professor Oak's place because Oak has, basically Pika, Red's Pikachu, has stumbled into Oak's lab, wounded from the battle that Red had fought in. And Oak, you know, scoops up Pika and puts him, you know, in this, you know, in his Pokeball and starts to heal him and so on and so forth. And Yellow comes in. And Yellow is like, oh, the Pikachu is here. And just takes the Pikachu, and Pika recognizes her. And so they just start to go out the door, and Oak's like, what the fuck? What? Who are you? Why'd you come in here? Why are you taking that Pokemon? Who are you? You know, yeah. Wanting answers. And Yellow's just like, I'm going to go rescue Red. It's like, what? I'm not going to trust you with this. And so he's like, okay, prove yourself to me. You know. If you're going to save Red, who is one of the greatest trainers in the world, you know, the previous league champion, then you need to prove yourself in a battle with me. And they have a fight, and Yellow wins without getting either of the Pokemon hurt.
Yeah.
And it's like...
And I get it. I get what her kind of theme is. Because people in chat are talking about, like, everyone has their speciality of, like, the Pokedex master.
I know.
I get what hers is. It's just, I think it's a combination of what she is combined with the fact that she has the magical ability to heal Pokemon telepathically that I'm like, alright, this is getting, like, what is she, a vampire too? Like, does she have every little OC character trait put in her? She's not as bad as she initially appears, and once you find out other people have that power too, and everyone of the Elite Four seems to have some ridiculous power, like, fucking Lorelai can fucking put voodoo ice shackles on you. It's just never explained. She just can do it. It's the weirdest shit in the world. So once you get to that, it's a lot easier to get into it, but for that brief moment when it first happens, you're just like, what is happening here?
Well, and plus you learn more about her, and the more you learn about her, the more flaws that you find about her character. Like, they make a big note, like, Blue's interaction with Yellow really helps to make her character, because Blue takes the standpoint of, look, you might be confusing kindness with weakness. You know, I know that you're very, you know, concerned with protecting the well-being of all Pokemon, but there's like a moment where they're trying to fight off this Gastly, and they launch this huge attack, and Yellow prioritizes rescuing a Caterpie that might be caught up in the fray. And that Caterpie becomes one of her signature Pokemon.
Yes.
But Green is like, you know, Red would have found a way to save that Caterpie and also defeat the enemy. If you want to do this, you actually have to get stronger. You can't just be this, you know, heal everything, befriend everything person. You have to be able to also fight. And so he takes her away for special training so that she can actually do that. So once you get to that point, it's like, okay, that makes sense. Although one thing that did bug me, because, and I never got over this, was I mentioned the evolution canceling thing earlier. She gets very upset when her Pokemon evolve.
Yeah, I mean,
she gets really upset.
She starts
upset
crying.
When they evolve.
Like, she immediately goes to bed crying because she's upset that her cute little Rattata is no longer Eradicate, or is now Eradicate rather. And in her defense, she does apologize the next morning. She's like, "No matter what you are, you're still always going to be Ratty to me." But she doesn't let her Pokemon evolve after that. Like, if she has the ability to, she won't let them evolve.
Because she likes her Pokemon the way that they are.
Yeah, and again, I can get it.
She doesn't want them to change.
Yeah, she doesn't want them to fight. She's not a battler. She just wants to make friends with Pokemon. I get it. In a way, she's essentially N from Black and White before N is even around.
So is Lance, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, Lance is also a huge douchebag. He's a big D-bag in this series.
Remember how awesome Lance was in Gold and Silver? He's kind of an asshole in this one.
Yeah. That's kind of the interesting, because we'll kind of speed this up, I guess, to cover the last bit of this. Essentially, the plot of Yellow is that the Elite Four aren't, like, lead-ins to the champion. They have some... They're called the Elite Four. I don't know what their purpose in the world is, but they're all evilness, and they have the goal of... I believe it's kind of like to make it so only the Elite survive and destroy kind of what the world has been doing to it. There's a little bit of an undercurrent of, like, man destroying nature kind of thing. But they're going about it in the wrong way. Like, of the four, only Bruno is kind of a good guy, and he's being mind-controlled at points to do more evil things than he wants to. So, the whole thing becomes, we have to stop him, and it gets to the point where even Team Rocket has to get involved and team up with the heroes into it. And that kind of gets to, like, the big one-on-one final fights that you get at the end of the series, and really kind of establishes the series as like a battle manga in a lot of ways. I know it's Pokemon and all that, but it really kind of sets up like the individual matchup sort of thing, and then gives everyone like their partners, you know, begrudging partners through things, and you get all that, and it's very cool. But essentially it all kind of is meant to follow up with the keystone that put badges in it, and an ancient Pokemon that they don't reveal, but I have to assume was either Lugia or Ho-Oh.
It was Lugia.
Yeah, kind of looked like Lugia at points, but they don't show it, I guess, because maybe the design...
Well, and also Blue makes reference to a Pokemon, a bird Pokemon that she encountered as a child.
Yeah.
And it's not the same one. So she had encountered Ho-Oh, and Lugia was the one they were trying to summon. Like in the second movie!
Just like it.
Silly second movie.
And there's cool things. There's cool fight scenes. I think it's pretty sweet. Like, you actually get some pretty entertaining fights between those characters. Like, that's where Green actually pretends that her arm gets lopped off after, you know, breaking the voodoo doll of her. And then it turns out her dismembered arm was actually just her Ditto, and she was pretending to lose it. And the Ditto fucking, like, you know, makes an attack and does cool shit. Like, those are really fun, entertaining fights. You know, you do get some development. Red shows up, has his kind of rematch with Bruno that's a pretty pimp fight between them. They finally have that weird Eevee that can evolve into all three forms and then turn back, get payoff. Like, they follow it up very nicely at the end, and I think the end is satisfyingly epic in a way that kind of helps to make the manga more tightly as a whole. Because if you were to judge it, I think, off just the first three volumes, which are like the red and blue part of the series, everything moves really quickly. There's not
a
lot...
Very fast-paced manga.
Yeah, there's not a lot of fanfare for things like catching a Pokemon or Pokemon evolving. Like, I literally missed... I blinked and missed his Ivysaur evolving into a Venusaur at one point. Because it just happens so insignificantly.
It happens during this climactic moment.
Yeah, it's...
Because, okay. Like, Blastoise and Charizard are already fully evolved, and they basically do the triple finish.
Uh-huh.
And Ivysaur, while it's chipping in with that, evolves into Venusaur.
Yeah, but it's like, from one panel to the next, he evolves, and now he's Venusaur. And I don't know. When you watch the anime, and then someone catching a Pokemon or evolving, it's like a fucking episode-long ordeal.
And it might honestly actually improve in that respect, because... From the point that we just stopped reading at, and the point that it continues on for the rest of the series has the same writer, but it gets a new artist. So, it did seem a little bit of a faster pace than I remember. I might have just been remembering it incorrectly, but I think that it actually does have a somewhat slower pace in order to give moments like that time to breathe going forward.
Yeah, and it would make sense, especially if future parts are always kind of length dependent on how long the games are in kind of, you know, mainstream popularity. So once the games start coming out like that, they're able to kind of, I guess, breathe a little bit more.
But overall, would you say that you enjoyed your experience reading Pokemon Adventures then?
I did. I need to like kind of hammer home, like, if I were to give one thing and call it like my childhood, Pokemon was it for me. Like, I was right kind of in the prime age group when the games came out. I had a habit of watching the Pokemon anime every day before I went to school. Like, it was, you know, I collected the cards, I played the card game, I played Smash Brothers and got Pikachu all the time. I love Pokemon, and it's cool now to kind of get to experience that story of Red and Blue and the Kanto region and all that through an entirely new medium. And that's really fun, it's really interesting, it's something I'm glad to have. Seeing the Pokemon in a manga form is interesting, of just seeing, like, how they give it more of a story and more of a narrative. And this part works in kind of taking what was a very simplistic part, because Pokemon, as gens come out, gets more and more complex between its Pokemon, its narrative, its mechanics, things like that. Taking relatively simple stuff and still making them entertaining. Like, there was never a point where I was bored or anything like that. Maybe confused, but never bored or anything like that. So, I really like it. I mean, there's definitely some places that I'm sure will improve as time goes on, but, you know, as a part one goes, I definitely dig it. Though, I can't recommend it to you if you don't know Pokemon. If you don't know the franchise, if this is something you're like, I'll get into Pokemon through this, play the games first or something, because it really does not explain anything. It assumes you know every part of it as you're going in.
I think that the first time that they actually bothered to explain stuff was, like, after Red had, like, 7 badges or something, so...
Yeah, because, like, even badge collecting is something that's just kind of, like, brought up.
Why is he getting badges?
Yeah, it never really explains, and it's not even his, like, point for the start of it. He just kind of wanders into getting, like, 4 badges in a row, and then he fights the other gym leaders and gets their badges, and... But it doesn't seem to mean anything, because I don't think the Elite Four or the championship even requires you to have... I don't know. It's very strange.
I think that the series gets more interesting as it goes on. Gold and Silver... Gold, Silver, Crystal, actually, technically, has a very cool climax, a really cool finale, and also some really cool fights that lead up into it. I really look forward to us getting into that one, and that's the entire rest of it. But, yeah, I'm glad that you aren't like, we're never going to read this again.
Yeah, I'm like,
this
Nick...
This is a terrible idea. Pokemon is ruined for me forever.
I'm like, Nick, from henceforward, we're just doing JoJo. It's just JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. There's no Pokemon.
Welcome to the weekly JoJo book recap.
Every time we do a new Pokemon part, I just shit on it harder and harder. Like, well, I could be reading JoJo right now! I could just get, like, that Kermit the Frog kind of, like, frown, like, alright. There we go. Let's,
Okay. Recap time.
Yes.
Recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. Let us begin with Black Clover, page 62, Rule of the Strong, which opens up with a cool little map of the underwater temple, which I do quite like. I like how you can kind of glance at it and be like, oh yeah, you can tell that Finral is trying to avoid the priest who encountered him. There's a little alcove where the game master and Yami are observing things from, and so on and so forth. It's a nice, neat little diagram.
Mm-hmm.
Although I am confused as to why there's only one, like, versus thing. Because it says specifically, it's like, oh yes, you know, Kito or Kirito, whatever the hell the son's name is fighting Asta. It's like, I'm pretty darn sure that the others that are nudged up against each other are fighting too.
Yeah, well, I guess it's maybe because they're full out going into a fight. Because you know Kahono and Noelle were in the same situation at the end of the last chapter. But I guess because Noelle's kind of, I don't know, maybe not the fighter everyone else is, she doesn't get that design. I don't know. But I don't want to dig too hard into it, I guess.
Well, they've also got Vanessa going up against one, and we see that she's already gotten him strung up. So, but yeah, that's how we actually open up the chapter, is Vanessa has beaten her foe, which puts the Black Bulls up 8-4. And so the High Priest is like, oh, these people are way tougher than I thought that they were. Ah, well, as long as my son and grandkids actually get serious, then we're going to actually turn this whole thing around. And gain confirmation that those three, at least that he was talking about, two of them are Kahono and what's his face. And also, the third is his son, which I guess that may make them the father of those two, probably.
Presumably, yeah.
Presumably. So then we go over to Kahono and Noelle, and Noelle is like, why did you teach me, help me to learn magic if you knew that I would encounter you down here? And she's just like, oh, you know, well, I figure that if you managed to actually come down, then we would actually be able to have this game. And if we win, then that would allow me to, go up onto the surface. So Noelle's like, so does that mean that you used me? No.
She's like, I used the shit out of you.
No. She's like, no, I actually did, want to be your friend. But now that we're fighting against each other, we should actually, see this through the finish. And I was like, well, if we're friends, then we shouldn't fight. And Gomo's just like, this is a shonen manga. We can be friends and still fight. And in a rather bizarre moment, Noelle rather lashes out against Kahono, but of course it swerves and misses. And Kahono's like, oh, wow, why did you miss me? And Noelle says, well, it's because I can't control my magic still. And Kahono says, no, Noelle, you are the demons. You are controlling your magic. You're just unconsciously trying not to attack people because you don't want to hurt anybody. Okay.
I can dig it. It's a concept that's been done before, but I like it here. Like, I always, to the day I fucking die, bitch about the Fighting Festival arc at Fairy Tail, because Loxus at the end, it's like, you can't use fucking fairy law because in your heart you don't want to hurt any of us. I'm like, bullshit, he set up like a failsafe plan to kill everyone in this town that only stopped because people shot it down. He's a dickhead. But this, you're like, I can understand that she maybe isn't someone who wants to hurt people, because she hasn't expressed that before, or having like a lot of anger towards people beyond, villains of the week or things like that. She's always just kind of been, Tsunade, but I guess you can see, and I can understand why she's someone who's like, I don't want to hurt people. She's a lover, Nick, not a fighter. That's why she doesn't wear pants. Fighters wear pants.
Oh, okay.
Lovers keep the hatch open.
She's 16.
So is it one else?
Good point. So we cut over to Asta and what, Kyoto?
I think it's. Can we just call him Kaito? Can I just pretend it's Annalisa?
With this stupid rat tail. He's using his dance magic and fighting against Asta. And Asta is having great difficulty fighting him because he can't just use his sword to cut the magic, because his magic is using is being used to avoid all of Asta's blows. Which makes sense, you know. Asta is a much kind of clumsier fighter. So Asta is just like, alright, well, I can't use magic, so I will simply recreate your technique with my body. And he fucking does! First goddamn try! Again with this motherfucker!
Oh god.
I'm so sick of this! Everything comes so easy to this asshole! Jesus Christ! Oh, I'll just learn to use ki. Bit, learn ki. Oh, I'll just recreate his dance magic with my body. Dit! So special magic this guy has. Training years to fucking use it. Is his dream to be a dancer, use his dance magic and show off how awesome his fear, and that's just like, I can do that too without using magic.
Anything you can do, I can do better.
Fuck ass. Right up the ass.
I mean, yeah, I can see it. I can understand the anger here. Maybe he's not defeated, though, because he doesn't seem like he's...
It doesn't matter if he wins or not. He did what he said he was going to. Easily. Literally. I'm gonna like, let's count this down. Wait a minute. Maybe brute strength isn't the way to go here. I should calm down and just become like water, too. He doesn't do it right the first time. 1, 2, 3, 4 panels go by, and then he dodges a blow properly. Blech. Fuck ass.
Okay. So he's not going to be your character of the week, I'm assuming.
No. Okay. We then cut away to Luck and Magna, and they have encountered the third of the elite priests, who uses water creation magic. He's the Hammerhead Priest, that I believe had encountered Finral.
I thought the Angfish encountered Finral, but I might very well be mistaken.
I don't know. Luck analyzes that this is actually the strongest of the nine priests there, and the guy conjures this giant hand holding a gavel in order to fight against them. Just as it seems like they're going to clash, this whale's head, it looks like, made of some type of magic, bursts in through the cave wall. And it's Weesh's guys.
It's... Well, is it all of them? It looks like it's just the beast guy.
It's at least the beast guy, and he's got... It's probably the beast guy and some followers.
But he does say, let us play, too.
Well, yeah, but he's got followers with him. You can see the cloaked guys in... the whale. But my point is, it might not be all of the elite people that save each. It might just be him and some other randos. So I guess that their contest is being interrupted, basically. Okay.
They came in with a whale, though. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Whale magic's pretty sweet. It's better than dance magic.
Until that whale talks. I'm not gonna be impressed by it.
I like this chapter up until the end. I was fine with it. I can understand the issues and criticisms with it, but I was digging this arc. I was getting into it. I thought it was progressing fine. And this seems like it should be a cool kind of end to it. Like, oh shit, the villain group's invading, but it's like, these motherfuckers did this last time, where there was a good arc going on, and they showed up, and then Leash was around for like 3 months, just getting his ass beat, so... My fear is that we're going to get the same thing here. Maybe we won't, because Yami can't get involved in this. Maybe he's like, I literally can't transport you in there. So, like, you know, the kids will kind of have to rise up and team up to overcome it. Or has to just cut them with a sword once in the gates. I don't know how it'll go. But it's still just that fact of Leashed Group have been nothing but a detriment to the series and my enjoyment with it thus far. So, I'm... cautiously of a stance of maybe it'll be good, but I'm not looking forward to it.
I just hate Asta.
Alright, well, that's fair enough.
Okay. Oh good, we get to talk about Bleach, man. Okay, Bleach, chapter 674. That's the number of it. Father 2. So, last time, Yuhabak backhanded Ichigo across the room in a very confusing and hard-to-follow sequence, and he's surrounded by darkness and eyeballs now. And Ichigo does what you would kind of expect him to, which is get back up and charge straight back towards him. And Yuhabak very casually is chiding him as Ichigo is trying to do this. And he even says, like, why did you bring that woman with you, referring to Rihime? Because, like, what do you even need her here for? And why are you bothering to actually charge in at me? You're basically just rushing into your death at this point. You're not treating your life with any value because of that. Oh, and by the way, your body and your power don't belong only to you. They belong to me, so.
Yoink.
He's obviously very confident in his own abilities, and Ichigo's really not looking so good by the time that we cut away from him. He's got blood streaking down everywhere because he's been cut across the face numerous times by tendrils of darkness and stuff. Unsurprisingly, Ichigo not beating the final villain very quickly.
How annoying would it be? Actually, what would you feel like he just beats in this chapter? Like he... Yuhabak's like, I should have used my power!
Ichigo just goes, oh, you're using tendrils of darkness. I can't do that, so I'll just match it with my body. And beats him.
I was gonna say, what if, like, the chapter began, he just fucking cuts him, and Yuhabak's like, oh, I shouldn't have gotten cocky and used my power to see that you would cut me in half in one blow! Just
why
dead.
Why turn off my power to see all? That's literally my whole thing.
And he's like the bad guy in a blockbuster movie that once he dies, all of the other Vandenreich and shit just like fucking short-circuit and die. So like everyone's done and they're like, all right, three chapters, we'll wrap this up and we're done. How would you even feel? Would you be furious with it or would you just be like, good, it's over?
Bleach is over, yay. I would probably have a good bitch fit about it.
Okay.
But then it would be like, oh, it's over now.
Then after a while, you're like, yeah, it's actually pretty sweet. I'll do it.
Thanks, Kubo. We cut over to the scene with Gerard. Renji and Rukia nearly get smashed by one of his giant hands, and Byakuya very casually scoops them out of the way. Like the scene where he just snatches them up and pulls them to safety. He's got this just look on his face. Just very calm and, like, unfeeling. I saved you. But then he tells them to just leave the battlefield and go to where Ichigo is. And they, of course, object initially, but he says, well, you can feel that spiritual pressure, right? You can tell that he's already confronting Yuhabak, and you... I'm not saying, like, you know, Kurosaki needs your help, but I'm saying we don't need you here. So you're... time would be better spent helping him out than helping me out. So they leave to go be with Ichigo, and Byakuya rejoins the Hitsugaya, and Hitsugaya's like, they knew you were just bullshitting them. Come on, seriously. And Byakuya's like, well, I wanted them to see through my bullshit.
Because they're needed there even if they're not.
It's such Bleach dialogue, you know?
It is. I feel like the past, like, 3 weeks have been really, like, over the top with Bleach dialogue. I kind of love it, though. Like, I just enjoy how ridiculous it's been a little bit.
Oh, God. So, yeah. Hitsugaya, kind of launches into a little bit of a tangent. Where he says, you know, I don't actually know if you ever intended the Academy for Soul Reapers, which actually is an interesting point, actually, because Byakuya, like, inherited the mantle of his family and stuff. So, that is actually a good point that this guy raises. But he says that, you know, when he attended the Academy, they didn't teach us to fight for our superiors or our families. All Soul Reapers ought to die protecting friends and humans. And Kurosaki is our comrade, but to them, he's a friend. So, yeah. basically sending them out there is he's agreeing with Byakuya based on that principle. It's like it's a good thing that you sent them out that way. But honestly, the lesson that he mains from the academy is actually kind of weird, because I get the whole thing where it's like, you know, you shouldn't fight for your superiors, you shouldn't fight for your families, you should die protecting humans. Okay, that makes sense. They're, you know, guardians of the afterlife and stuff. That makes sense. And friends. Which kind of negates the whole don't fight for your families thing to me. It's a little weird. A little weird. I don't know. Maybe it's some sort of Nakama line. I don't know. But it's weird. It's like, don't protect these people who are important to you personally. Protect these people who are important to you personally.
Like, this is what matters.
Families suck. Families overrated.
Sure.
We cut to Hoshvolt and Ishida. Hoshvolt won, I guess.
I don't even know anymore.
For Ishida. Oh, God. Ishida's just lying on the ground. It's kind of bleeding out. Blood trickling all over the ground and stuff. And Hoshvolt is standing over him. He's got his sword in hand. Speeching him. He gets this really, really long speech about, you know, what it means to be, you know, to be in balance of life. You know, the life is a balance of right and wrong. And all those bits of right and wrong pile on top of one another to define who we are. And that's who you are, Ishida. But I don't see what you've become through your acts of right and wrong. I don't see your choices. So who are you? Are you Ishida? Ishida just says, you talk a lot. So does everybody in Bleach.
Yeah, like you just noticed this now?
Yeah, seriously. And Ishida responds by saying, who am I? How can I answer that? And he summons a Quincy bow. That's something I'll finally find out when I defeat you people. God, this isn't good writing.
Like, oh, please just end it. I know before I was like, can we get more Uryu? But if he was going to be like this, then you could have just left him off.
So lame.
I want to like him, because I like Uryu. But this, he has not been making the strongest impression since he's kind of come back into the series, unfortunately.
Oh, God. Chris, you know what this whole sequence was missing? Another group to cut away to. Because Ryukin and Ishin are there! Yay!
Yeah.
The chapter ends with them showing up and talking about it. It's like, we're here because of something that your dad made, Ryukin. Yes. I'm glad that my dad was so sneaky. Ah.
Credits.
I'm done. Move on to something else.
Alright. Well then, we'll move on to Fairy Tail.
Unohana's dead. I've forgotten that like the last month. I know.
You got it when dead. It counted. You smacked your camera so hard.
Yeah.
Oh God. Nick, calm down.
Fairy Tail.
Alright. Let's jump into Fairy Tail, chapter 486, The Fourth Guest. Last time, Gajiel had squared off against Bradman, and it basically just impaled him into a wall and was like, you know, this is what you get for reminding me of the worst thing I ever did in my life. And basically just continues the fight between them, and Bradman's like, you're dead already! And Gajiel's like, no, I'm not. And I'm just going to cut to this now, because there's a lot of stuff in the meantime. But basically, Bradman's powers, he is made of anti-magic particles. So literally, being near him is just cancerous to mages and kills them. But Gajiel was kind of immune to that because his body's iron, so he can't actually have it affect his lungs or anything like that. He's immune for the moment being. But we cut away to Irene and her two associates, and they're like, no, don't worry about, you know, Gain intervening, because those are just the second guests to arrive. Now come the third guest, and they might be a little bit of trouble. And we cut away to some goofy-looking airship.
A moving temple, Olympia.
It's so doofy looking. Like, I don't know why. It's just a big straight on tower with stupid wings and like a fucking cannon on the top.
For me, the stupid part is the legs, honestly.
Yeah, like it just looks
like the AT-ST legs with feathered wings too.
Yeah, like why does it look like a robot ultimately, but it has wings like a bird? Like, whatever. It's the Oration 6 or all the non-evil members of it, which I really wouldn't have recognized at first if not for the giant stupid like square-faced guy in the back who I kind of picked out, and Racer. But all of them are there, essentially, except for, I guess, Brain was the one.
Including Metaton EX. I forgot that this guy was with them. Metaton. I don't even remember his name.
Which one's that?
The flamboyant guy on the right.
Oh, yeah. I forget what his name was. He had, like, Twisted Magic or something. Well, I know the guy in the left Cobra was the Poison Dragon Slayer. That's why he's, like, so sick. And the girl in the middle was one of the Stellar Spirit Mages. I think that's Yukino's older.
Yeah,
older sister.
And they have a little moment where Yukino seems to sense her presence. Like, yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember. They are siblings.
Yes. But
she's still not going to do anything important. But.
Yeah. Well, thank God these guys came in. So we cut back to Irene, and she's like, but the most troublesome one will be the fourth guest. They're like, oh, you mean even more coming? They're like, well, I don't know if it's going to be a friend or an ally. Perhaps neither, but, you know, it's going to be a really important person.
And at this point, it's like, Sacrilogia.
Yeah.
Sacrilogia.
Yeah, essentially.
Who else would it fucking be?
Spoilers.
Is it going to be Makarov?
They're like, you showed up. I'm like, to do what? Get punched and knocked out? We cut away, and there's some very creepy fan service jokes about Lucy's tits being shrunk and expanded.
Well, so they're riding on Giant Happy, and Brandish is just like, oh, he's so fluffy. And Natsu's head is huge, because he was so intrigued by Happy being made large that he wanted to do it. And Lucy's upset because Brandish only made his head really huge. Which is kind of funny, I think. Because Natsu's like, yeah, I'm huge! And it's just his head is really big. And then Brandish decides to mess with Lucy by first making her flat-chested and then giving her, like, triple Z cups.
Yeah.
And it's like, well,
I don't know why this.
Some artist's going to be making about 10 different not safe for work images on that little thing.
Yeah, a lot of people just found their fetish right there. But essentially, I don't think anything even really comes of this conversation. Like, they all just note that there's a really strong power coming.
Yeah.
And they're kind of getting.
We go straight from Lucy going, stop messing with my tits! To strong magic powers in the.
Yeah. So, I think they're basically coming up upon August. You know, the strongest man in this friggin' 12. And, you know, Irene talks about how she has to make some preparations because, you know, she won't be the one who loses. She'll have the last laugh. And she notes Agnologia, the Wings of Darkness, is the one who's coming. And then finally we cut back to Bradman. As I said, he explains that he's anti-magic particles, so he should be dying. And he is, that's why he's the god of death, because he is literally death around him. Everyone dies. I'm like, isn't Xerath that same thing, but better? I feel like you should really kind of be superfluous when Xerath's around.
Right.
It's
a cool thing, because he establishes my entire body is made of magic barrier particles. Like, there's no part of me that you can actually hurt.
Yeah, I'm like a Logia, essentially.
And so there's this standstill, really, between them, because Gajito can't be poisoned by his anti-magic particles, but
every time he hurts him, he risks more of his teammates and friends getting killed, because the particles are spreading. And that's the point when Levi activates her script magic and creates masks for at least herself. I presume she does it for other people as well, so she literally has a word that says mask that she's using as kind of a filter for the anti-magic particles. And, you know, Gajeel's telling her, like, get out of here. He's going to kill you. You know, it's not going to work. Get out of here. And she's like, don't you die. I'm not giving up. I want you to keep living. And they have, like, a little brief moment there. Bradman kind of takes off his cloak, and we see what his full appearance looks like. And he really looks like a Dragon Ball Z villain.
He really does.
Like, he looks straight out of Dragon Ball Z.
That's a Frieza/Cell head right there.
Yeah. And the chapter ends as we cut over to Western Fjord as Xerif is feeling the ground. He's like, the quality of the magic in the earth has changed. Irene, what are you planning to do? And that's the chapter.
As with most fairy tale chapters, it's kind of up and down. I really did like the stuff with the Gajeel's fight with Bradman. And I like the moment at the end with Lovey getting involved. And it's like, oh, you know, the biggest, like, couple in the series at this moment is actually going to have a fight together.
Yeah, I like the idea that they would have a battle together. And I like the fact that her magic is coming in, like, just fully useful in this moment, too.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully that fight lives up to my suddenly raised expectations. Let's move on to Food Wars now. Shokugeki no Soma, we are on chapter 167. Last time, Izami basically indicated that there would be a second step to the purge for the students that oppose them. And we pick that up in chapter 167, The Face You See, which several pages in, we get this kind of cover page, which basically recasts a bunch of the characters as, like, Final Fantasy kind of RPG characters. Very midgetified. I like the panel. It's very stylistic.
Yeah, that's cool. And we get idea that Camouflage Bikini Girl is going to be presumably a bigger character in this arc as well, because she's featured on it.
Well, it might just be because it's like, fuck it, it's Soma and a bunch of girls.
True.
But we open up with Tsukasa making the announcement for a bunch of people. And I like how he's just like, I'm not good at public speaking. Why can't one of you guys do it? So like, go do it!
Get out there!
So he explains that, like, you know, the advancement exams, a lot of the times in the past, they've actually been very, very, very testing trial. Like, last year, 190 students attempted it, only 76 passed. And they were forced to leave. But this year's going to be different because Dean Izami has freed you from such unnecessary and cruel competitions. This year, the advancement exams have been changed to be a simple review of your understanding of the Izami method of cooking. Just show what you've learned, the skills and techniques we have been teaching you, and everything will be fine. But he then goes on to say, for those of you who still refuse to conform to Dean Izami's policies, it will be a good lesson in what ultimately awaits you. So everyone is just watching this, and everyone at the Polaris Storm, save Soma, is very gloomy because, you know, he's like, okay, guys, you know, let's do our best to take on this exam like we've done all of the others. And they're like, don't you get it? If we don't follow the Izami, you know, syllabus, then basically they're going to just use that as an excuse to expel us all. They're going to use that to say we failed and that's it. So they're like, yeah, it doesn't matter how good a dish you actually prepare for it, they'll just nitpick it to death and they'll fail us. And, you know, Arina probably won't be expelled, obviously, but she's going to be left, you know, all alone here because all the people who are trying to support her are in opposition to the Izami regime. And so we're all going to be expelled because of that. There's, like, nothing we can do. And it gets to the point, actually, where they're all, like, just very downtrodden and think there's nothing we can do. It's almost played for laughs, because they're like, that's all right, home to the people who supported us, so that we can apologize for not making it, and so on. In the meantime, we have this cool little moment where a bunch of students who have conformed are presenting their dishes, and they're like, oh, it's so wonderful! You know, the judges are of course, saying that, but the one professor who was in opposition to Izami, he's still around, by the way, Mr. Chappelle.
Yes, the French teacher, I believe.
He's like, I mean, yeah, it's delicious. It's great. But when I take a bite of this, the only thing that comes to mind is Izami Nakiri's face, and there's this big full-page spread of him clutching his head while Azami's face litters the background over and over again. And he's like, you know, this isn't what Tsutsuki Institute is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about students clashing against each other in order to build each other up. and when a student comes out of it, their face should be the only one that I see when I prepare a dish. It shouldn't just all be seeing a zombie's dish with every single student. And he imagines, like, you know, a chef agreeing to have his hands shackled in order to survive at the Institute. Just a nice little recap over the course of a few pages of what's happening at the Institute from this side character's perspective. Then we have that whole scene where all the people at Polaris are like, oh god, we're all going to fail. There's nothing we can do, and so on and so forth. Soma's just like, oh well, I'm gonna go back to my room, maybe sharpen my knives. It's best to just remain grounded in situations like this. And everyone's like, ah, it's so terrible.
I hate you, Soma.
Oh, why are you relaxed, you fucktard? At that moment, Hisako is like, I should go, you know, be there for Miss Arina. I'll be by her side and protect her. And she realizes that Arina is missing. And Arina knocks on Soma's door and comes in. And that's where the chapter ends. And it's, I say that, you know, very, very quickly, but it's something that's, like, very slowly laid out over the course of these two pages. Because, you know, Soma's in thought in his room, thinking about what Tsukasa told, you know, announced. Arina knocks on his door, asks to come in, opens the door. There's a full page spread of her just coming in the door, and then the last page is her just standing in front of him.
Yeah.
It's given, like we mentioned this when we were talking about Pokemon earlier, it's given a whole lot of time to breathe, because if you've been, you know, following the build-up of this, it's something that's really been built up for quite a while in terms of the way that Arina has treated someone to this point. Because it seems like something is weighing on her mind and she is actually going out of her way to talk to Soma about it. And we don't know exactly what she's going to say, but the fact that she is actually respectfully approaching him as opposed to just kind of tolerating his existence indicates a really big step forward for her. But that's
It's kind of a weird chapter, though, because it ends on a note that isn't particularly, like, find out what happens next week. Like, it's not something where I'm like, what happens? Like, I have to know or something like that.
I guarantee you, like, in the original Japanese, it probably had all these side captions that says, like, Arina Daikiri approaches Soma. She wants to discuss... ... you know?
Yeah, like, it's something that, you know, maybe even seems suggestive at a point, but I don't think it's anything like that. I imagine it's her kind of just trying to
Soma,
warn him.
Soma, you're going to leave. And you're the only one I trust to take my virginity.
It's like, wow, this got really adult.
This
really.
Came out of nowhere.
I don't know if I'm comfortable reading this. No, I mean, it's not a bad chapter or anything like that. It's just not a particular... Like, this is a chapter I'll forget, you know, after this podcast is done. Just because nothing really particularly notable happens within it, you know. Everything in it's okay.
It's more about what happens next than anything else.
Basically.
No, I get that. It does get me excited for what happens next, but I do think that it's cool the way that the moment of her just entering his room plays out, but it's really like, oh, I really want to see what happens next week, as opposed to, this chapter was really cool, and I want more. So. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, My Hero Academia! We get a cool little two-page spread to open things up, where apparently, Deku's entire class is turned into weirdos, except for him. I don't exactly get what's going on. They're all striking these weird poses. Is this a reference to something?
No. It probably is. I'm not quite getting it.
Anyhow. We get a bit of a recap of the last chapter with Deku and Ida and Kirishima managing to get Bakugo out of danger, Ida basically tells Bakugo, alright, we need you to sync up, you know, sync your explosions with my Recipro, and Bakugo's like, how about you sync up with me?
Oh, the dream team's falling apart already!
Oh, God. How could this have happened? All of the villains are like, oh, shit, they're getting away. Where the fuck did these people come from? How did this happen? We've got to, you know, take them out. Who here has a long-distance attack? And they're like, well, Dobby and Kurogiri have them. They're both unconscious, though. Magna, the big-lipped guy with sunglasses, reveals his quirk, which is magnetism. And specifically, he can magnetize any person who is close to him. Men become South Poles and women become North Poles, but he can't magnetize himself. Really, really weird set of, like,
very specific
conditions. Yeah. Very specific. But he used this in a really cool way to get the condenser magician guy because he has two guys with identical poles. They then repel each other, and so one of them is sent flying through the air. He's like, all right, let's, you know, go get them. But then Mount Lady suddenly grows up in front of him, and he collides with her face instead, and so that blocks him. And they're like, oh my god, Mount Lady. She's like, I rescued you, and she bolted over and punches.
Huzzah!
A cool little moment for her, though. Up until this point, Mount Lady was this kind of weird,
slightly
jokey
fan service kind of thing.
Which they seriously, by the way, if you've seen the anime, seriously play that element of her character up.
I didn't really even realize she was until I had seen like some stuff from the anime, and I was like, oh, okay.
Well, I think that she, like...
Well, it has been a
while. Line, it's like, it's nice to meet your ass-quaintance, and she just, like, twists her ass towards all the onlookers, and, like, a horde of 20 people with cameras are all taking pictures of her. It's just like, well, this moment is significantly more played up than it was in the manga.
Like, yeah, it's a bit pretty silly.
But cool moment for her, being a hero, I like that.
Yeah.
And in addition, Gran Torino flies into the scene and knocks out the three villains before they can regather themselves. Basically the kids are going to get away. And Gran Torino is also on the scene to help out All Might, who at this point is really not looking like he's in good shape. He's, you know, starting to cough into his hand and so on and so forth. But he turns his attention back to All for One, who extends his tendrils again to use his Force Quirk ability, and this time he forces Magna's quirk to get Toga magnetized. And because she's magnetized, he then gets all of Tamura and company magnetized, so they're all drawn towards her, and they all fly through the portal that he opened up with Kurogiri. And there's this, you know, brief moment where, you know, Shigaraki is reaching out for his master. He's like, no, I'm not ready. And All for One just says, as he disappears, you will continue this war. It's a very weird moment because it's very sacrificial hero type of
villains. Well, people have mentioned that essentially, this conflict between All Might and All for One is both sides making sacrifices in, you know, to protect their young mentees, essentially, like the people they're trying to build into the next generation. So it's this weird moment where you're like, holy shit, like the villain's also making these like crazy sacrifices to try to protect the people, the person important to him. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't expect this generally. Usually the villain's like, you're holding me back, fuck you.
Or he could be acting.
Yes, there's nothing saying he's still a good guy. He could still be a real shit.
All Might, you know, turns his attention directly to All for One, charges and tries to attack him. There's a cool moment where All for One uses his ability to warp Gran Torino in the way of the blow, so he takes the punch instead. Can you not hear me? Seriously? All right. Okay. Anyhow, All for One, you know, launches into this brief little speech where he says to All Might, I detest you. There was a time when you ran around taking out my allies right and left with those fists of yours, and they called you the symbol of peace because of it. You stood so tall atop all of our sacrifices. How is the view from up there? And All Might is just like, you know what, fuck this. Just...
He's like, pretty sweet, dickhead. Bam!
Grabs Gran Turismo out of the way, punches him with his other hand, and All For One is like, oh, well, you know, I can still tell you're not fighting at full power, because for heroes, there are oh so many things worth protecting, and even though the kids are out of there, there are bystanders in the destroyed buildings that they've been wrecking during the course of their fight. And All Might says, shut up. That's what you do. You toy with people's very lives. You break them. You steal from them. You take advantage and manipulate them. You sneer at them when they're just trying to live their everyday lives. And for that, I can't forgive you. And he punches straight into All For One's helmet, shatters the faceplate, and punches, presumably, the face beneath it. And just as he strikes that seemingly decisive blow, his powers reach their limit and he starts to revert into, you know, his Toshinori form. He's still got some muscles, but you can see, you know, his hair is getting back into the disheveled state. He's starting to revert. And All For One continues to mock him and he says, you're getting really emotional. And I remember hearing that exact line once before from the previous person to inherit One For All, Nana Shimura. Now, I want to note, I looked back after reading this chapter, and I had completely forgotten when they mention Shigaraki's real name, Shimura, that they had said that the previous person to have the One For All power was a person named Shimura. We didn't have their full name at that point, but they said Shimura multiple times in a conversation between All Might and Gran Torino. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wait. Oh, the last person to have this power was related to Shigaraki. Oh. Maybe that's why he found Shigaraki. Because keep in mind, All For One killed that person. You know, the last person to hold that power. So, it really does kind of play into like, oh, you know, the person who held this power that directly opposes me, I will turn their family member to the side of darkness and so on and so forth. It would be a very, very, very douchebag evil thing to do.
Yes.
I get the feeling that we're going to learn a little bit more about the relationship between the two powers in the next chapter. This was a pretty badass chapter in its own right, with the punching and also just the moments of, you know, the great, great back and forth talking between them and so on and so forth. I'm not sure exactly what happened here with this, because you don't see a face beneath the mask. You just see, like, it looks like bandages. And there's some sort of goop that flies out of the helmet also when All Might breaks it, that somewhat resembles the, you know, teleportation goop that he was using before. So I'm not sure if that implies that he has actually escaped or what exactly happened.
Well, his fist, All Might's fist is broken through it, but it's kind of, like, it makes a squish sound in his head. So, mm-hmm. Maybe this dude's just all brain, or, you know, something
it's
else.
Grabby! It's grabby!
Oh my god.
I got imaginative, finally.
Yeah, I imagined a much better series to be in. I didn't see this one coming, Nick. Not gonna lie, pretty shocked by this. Uh-huh. It's a cool chapter, though. I definitely dig it. I'm pretty excited to see, like, what kind of can happen from here. Like, is this where All Might goes down? Because if he's transforming back, he's in a pretty shitty spot if this fight's not done.
The people in the chat are pointing out, I was like, well, what parts of his face we saw before looked like this? Because it's all scarred over and stuff. And I don't know, because All Might is reacting in shock to what's happened, and it seems to be because he didn't cause nearly as much damage with his punch as he would have liked to. He broke the mask, but it didn't seem to actually hurt him much. But yeah, I really like this chapter. Let's move on.
Yes, let's go. Moving on to... I guess it'd be... I don't know if you want to mention Nisekoi.
What happened to Nisekoi? There's an interesting bit with Yui that happens, because basically she manages to fix the problem with the locket that's been there for a while by, you know, getting the key shard out of it so that, you know, the key that actually opens it can now work. And she kind of mentions to her follower, like, you know, I didn't do that before because I wanted him to actually choose me specifically or something like that. And she mentions that to Raku, too. And also, everyone arrives at the one place that they're going to meet up with Chitage at. Claude is there to intercept them, and it seems as though Sugumi is going to fight him.
Yeah, Sugumi's coming in for the save.
Which I'm glad to see that she gets a little bit more to do in the finale. Because it occurred to me as like, oh yeah, there was kind of some like unresolved stuff going on there, because Claude's still very much against Raku doing anything, basically.
Claude's still like, fuck you, you're not the end of dater.
But anyway, that's really about all I have to say about that. Takuan and Batsu.
Well, no, One Piece.
One Piece, yeah.
Can we just do
Takuan and Batsu really quickly anyway?
Oh, you're gonna fuck up my whole ordering of things.
Shut up. Takuan has to be able to unleash his ogre transformation whenever there is a lot of awkward fan service involving Batsu's panties getting stolen by a panty thief demon guy. Takuan manages to get the determination to unleash his ogre transformation abilities basically by just, like, dedicating himself to other people instead of getting really pissed off. Batsu punishes the panty thief by cursing him to never receive pleasure from the thought of panties again.
It's gonna make intercourse really difficult for him.
Seems appropriate, I think. Also really creepy images of, panties that have teeth.
Yeah, panty monsters.
There's something missing in this series. I like parts of Batsu's character. Like, I like the whole, you know, everything must be in balance thing. So, like, she's trying to get Takuan to train by doing all these, you know, hellish things. And then she's like, because, like, you know, she sits on him while he's trying to do sit-ups and push-ups and stuff. And then she's like, okay, now I'll do them while you sit on top of me. So, it's, you know, it's pretty ridiculous, but it's comedic. But then it just, there's too much fan service in this series, I think, for my liking. It's way too focused on it, and it does it in such weird ways.
It's a series that at the start kind of felt like it was definitely going to be very fan service-y, but now that we've gotten two chapters into it, and it's, you know, been ramped up, you could definitely, like, sit here and say, like, oh, it's really going to be a fan service-y kind of series, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, it's just that's pretty... If that's the only substance your series has, it's easy for me to, like, just start tuning out of it, sort of.
Do you mind starting up talking about One Piece? I gotta get more water.
Sure, yeah, no, that's not a problem. Let's talk about One Piece, chapter 826, 0-4, with our cover page of Mihawk and Perona. So last time, the Straw Hat crew with Luffy super poisoned from eating the fish that you shouldn't have eaten the skin from, and that's all that Luffy did. Have run into a ship. They were looking for Big Moms. Instead, they ran into one of the Germa 66 ships, where somebody on board looked a lot like Sanji. And that's where we pick up. Everyone's like, you know, hey, it's Sanji up there! Oh, we found him already! Thank God! Sanji! And he's just kind of looking down at them, glaring. And even, like, Chopper's just like, Sanji, quickly! We have trouble! Luffy's dying from eating a poisonous fish! You know, are there any antidotes? And the mysterious person says, I'm not Sanji. Why do you keep calling me that? I don't blame you, though. My name is Yonji. And we get his introduction, Germa 66 Windscreen Vinsmoke Yonji. And he looks very, very similar to to Sanji. I think some people have said that the eyebrows are going in a different direction, but I don't think they are, but I can't remember off the top of my head. And everyone's like, oh, he looks so cool. And I just find it funny because, you know, like, Nami's like, oh, wow, he has a younger brother. Like, how could you tell? And his response is really just like, oh, wow, what a hottie! And then, of course, that all that does is reaffirm it.
Heart bulging eyes and like full on Tex Avery reaction. Yeah.
And all that does is affirm it more for Chopper. He's like, I knew it was you, Sanji!
Oh, Chopper. Yeah, they're talking to Yonji on the ship, and then Chopper calls out to him. He's like, wait, Sanji! I told you I'm Yonji! And because Luffy is still poisoned and getting worse and worse because they know, like, Luffy has really powerful antibodies in his system, but the rashes that the poison has conjured are spreading. I mean, his resistance is about to give out, and he's spasming and coughing while unconscious, and Nami and Carrot are both freaking out. They don't have an antidote to treat him any because they used them all up, and Brooke begs for help from him. And Anji is like, nope.
Suck it.
He's like, yeah, if you're pirates, why don't you, you know, try plundering our ship and taking the cure from us? And Nami gets really pissed off by saying, it's like, you know, you guys might, you know, both have the, you know, perverted playboy personalities, but that's the only similarity between them. You know, Sanji, you know, is way kinder than him. And Pedro is, I like the little, I like this really tiny little moment from him where Pedro's like, eh, if you want, we'll fight.
Let's do it.
Yeah. But, at that moment, I'm not sure exactly what happens. Oh, he gets roundhouse kicked in the head.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, he blocks it, but still gets knocked into the water. Reiju appears. Lady Reiju, who is Sanji's sister. Well, I'll give Oda this. She's taller than the other woman he draws, at least.
Yeah, she has the same face, but like the rest of her, I guess, is kind of like old school anime-ish, different enough that you could not immediately call foul on it.
Because her legs are absurdly freaking long. Like, they're longer than the entire rest of her body, basically.
Yeah.
And also, she also has the swirly eyebrow. But they note, like, that the Vinsmokes are wearing these shoes that just allow them to float on the water. Exhibiting the technology that they have because they've got, you know, Royal Dynasty, I guess, resources, I believe. And Peckham's notes that, like, yeah, you know, they're part of a battle force that utilizes science to fight, which is what Mama wants out of them. That's why she's interested in uniting the two families. And they have this little note because Brooke is like, yeah, well, Vinsmoke, aren't they, you know, a royal dynasty? And everyone there is kind of surprised. They're like, oh, really? They're that famous? And they kind of look at Brooke like, how do you know that? He's like, well, I'm really old. Reiju notes, we didn't used to be a royal line. We still are. Jirma is a nation without land. We own no territory, but we have the right to attend the reverie. Which is interesting. It's a royal family that has no kingdom, I guess. But she goes over to the Straw Hat's ship, and she bends over Luffy and creeps on him, basically.
Yeah, she's like, oh, I'm gonna make this... Remember that one time a fucking Amazon tugged on your dick for a while? I'm gonna make this more creepy than that. That is so weird that there was just a point in Amazon Lily arc where the Amazons were, like, unintentionally jerking Luffy off.
What is this thing? I don't understand.
It just keeps growing and stretching back.
She knows, like, oh, he's very particular effects from a poison. You know, this can, like, kill a giant on contact normally. But she then says, well, as it so happens, this poison is my favorite. And she gives Luffy mouth-to-mouth and starts sucking the poison out of his body. And Chopper's like, won't you die if you suck out the poison? And Brook is like, I'm so jealous! God. But she sucks in all the poison, and complete with Luffy, his legs kind of kicking up and then collapsing back down. She refers to herself as Poison Pink. It's kind of like not really providing any context to it.
Well, they all have like nicknames because the Sanji's brother is Witchet Green.
Okay.
So, and actually kind of fits,
too. So they could
too.
Form Power Rangers.
Yeah, well, they all have numbers, too. Like, you'll notice that Yanji has a 4 on him, and we all know Sanji means 3, or that's, like, kind of the playoff of it. I can't tell what her number is. I've seen people saying it's 0, but...
Well, it looks... Well, because it's... Because 0 and 4 is the name of it. And I guess she's got... Because she's got the... I guess the bullseye marks on her are supposed to be zeros, maybe?
Very possibly. Yeah. And it also somewhat kind of fits in, too, with Sanji's whole title, too. The Black Lake Sanji, Poison Pink.
Yeah. So, Luffy wakes up immediately after having been, you know, comatose this entire time. And he's like, last thing I remember, I was eating fish. That skin was so good. Is there any left? And now he's like, no!
I fucking love that. I love that fish. Is there any more?
No!
God damn it!
And so Luffy looks up at Raichu and is like, Sanji, you're here! And even Chopper is like, she's a girl!
God damn it, Luffy!
Raichu says, you know, I want to thank you for what you've done for my brother up until now. You know, we were separated at a very young age, and our father has constantly been searching for him. But 2 years ago, there was a bounty poster that someone resembled him, and so father had Navy headquarters in hot pursuit after him. It turned out to be a different person. But when the government told us that Black Lake Sanji had been captured in film, my father personally bumped up the bounty and had dead or alive turned into only alive on the poster. You know, filling in the gaps that we kind of figured on, but nice to know that this isn't just something that they're like, oh, wait, Sanji's alive, we have to marry him off.
Yeah.
It's like, they have actually been searching for him ever since he disappeared when he was just a child. And then immediately, after they get the explanation, Luffy goes, hey, Sanji's sister, thanks for saving my life. But give Sanji back! He's my friend.
Yeah, give him back, bitch!
And Yonji is like, yeah, I told you, you know, you just saved an enemy, you shouldn't have done that. And he also questions why Peckham's is with the Straw Hats, because, you know, he should be allied with Big Mom and so on and so forth. Raichu shoots back over to the Vince Smoke's ship, and she says, for right now, we're going to pretend we didn't see anything. And Yonji agrees to this because they're like, yeah, we don't want to get in trouble. This could ruin our brother's marriage, so we'll keep this a secret. And they just go their separate ways, and that's really it. Aside from cutting to below the surface of the ocean, where a merman is communicating with someone... Well, he's screaming with Jinbei.
Yeah, well, it's, I feel like the merman we're seeing there is the doctor from, the merman crew that we met a while back when Arlong and, Tiger Lily, I think was his name? Fishman Tiger, the one that whole flashback we got with Arlong and Jinbei.
Right.
That's, I think, Aladdin, I believe was his name? And he was, like, I think the doctor of that crew. And, he's communicating with Jinbei, so... Finally, after...
A couple of years.
I feel like it's been like 3 or 4 years since Jinbei officially joined the Straw Hat as their 10th member. He might finally join back up with them again.
Is he officially
a member of the Straw Hats. He officially accepted. He just did not join the, stay on the ship with them. He was accepted into the crew. Luffy asked him to join. He accepted. He just said, I have to do something first.
So he promised that once he was ready, he would return to Luffy again and request to join his crew. Okay. He was invited to join the Straw Hats, but declined to be having unfinished business of being affiliated with Big Mom, but promised that he would join them when he was done with that. Okay.
Yeah.
So, he's a reserve Straw Hat, a reserve adventure, you know.
But the idea is that he'll presumably join the crew.
But, I did really grow to like Jinbei during the Fishman Island arc. I think one of my favorite moments is because, you know, he had that much more subtle sense of humor to his character than a lot of the Straw Hats had. I love that moment where they're preparing for the final battle and he's like, now, this plan needs a name.
Yeah, I initially wasn't too crazy on the idea of him joining until they started to, give him some humor and gave him some goofy traits. You eventually find out he's kind of just a silly weirdo, too, in his own way.
He just has a lot more dignity about himself.
Yeah, he just carries himself a little bit better.
But yeah, we got to hear from Jinbei again. Hey, he might actually get involved, considering he was, specifically, trying to cut off his, ties to Big Mom, considering the Straw Hats are going to be, seeing her or her crew soon. Maybe they'll encounter each other again during this arc.
I have to imagine that's what this is all building up to.
So, with that said, let us move on to Toriko, Gourmet 371, Confrontation of Eras. Acacia arrived last time along with Joey, and all of the important characters are there with God, basically. And there's a cool opening to the chapter where Acacia lays his eyes on God, and he's like, huh? What's with all these flies buzzing around it? There's two big ones and four smaller ones. And basically, it then kind of cuts back to reality and reveals that he's talking about Toriko and company as just these flies buzzing around his dish, basically.
It is interesting that I guess the two strongest are then Toriko and Star June.
Presumably, yeah. But I just love that moment, that little bit where, he's just kind of like not even paying attention to them. He doesn't even realize they're there because he's so focused on God. And Toriko makes this really angry face. He's like, you're Acacia? And Acacia just looks at him. And he's like, oh, I guess my reputation precedes me. Yeah, I am
pretty awesome.
Yeah. And all of the people there are like, we know who you are. Yeah, you're the founder of the Eighth, the Gourmet, and so on and so forth. And he's just like, since you all know who I am, I guess that means you should be treating me with respect, then. Yeah. Wipe those angry looks off your faces. Come on, worship me.
He's like, I am pretty awesome, aren't I?
I have really grown to like Acacia over the last several chapters. Now that they have really started pushing him as the villain, he just, has the body and powers of Neo. I'm a lot more interested in what he can do.
Because when there's a personality behind it all, it's a lot more engaging.
Mm-hmm. When it's just a guy going, I'm gonna eat you. It's just like, fucking who cares? But, a guy who will go, oh yes, Jiro, those tears were fake. Or, where are all these flies doing buzzing around my meal? I wonder what it's like for humanity to have all hope snuffed out. That's what it must be like when they're devoured by Neo. Just some arrogant asshole evil villain. That's what I like more than just,
I have a big nose.
Anyhow. So Acacia is just kind of gazes on Star June and Toriko with kind of bored curiosity, basically. He literally basically says, these are the two big flies. What's their deal? They're glaring at him. They're like, you've killed Jiro. I can detect that Jiro's scent disappeared near yours, so I know that happened. But also, before in case you can really apply to that, Joey says, "Oh, so you knew that I won too." Dorica says, "You didn't win anything."
Yeah, I love that line too, where she's just like, "Oh, so you know that I won too." He's like, "You didn't win anything." And her expression isn't like anger, it's kind of just like blank speechlessness, but you kind of get the impression she's like, "Fuck you. I sealed him in a can."
And Toriko is, you know, just goes straight back to Acacia after that. He says, "You know, why did you do that to your own pupil?" And Acacia launches into a little bit of a speech by saying, "This will be the last time I speak to a human. I've always wondered what I am. I was about 4 or 5 years old when I became initiated as a genuine gourmet hunter. I don't remember what the ingredient was, but I know that already the beast of hunger lurked within me. All I remember is how I couldn't suppress it. Who I was and what that beastly hunger was were questions I asked myself day after day." And he goes on to explain that basically he chased after all these new ingredients to try and escape his own hunger, his own endless appetite. But eventually, there were no more kingdoms to conquer, basically. Yes. There were no more new ingredients before me. All that was left was a mountain of stacked up empty plates and my own empty self. And he still hadn't escaped from his own appetites. And when the one who answered the question that I've been asking was the appetite itself, and he whispered to me that there were still so many flavors I had yet to know, so many ingredients I had yet to see. And so I continued to run, but the place I'd reached at last wasn't my goal. It was just the starting line. And I only left one word for each Ryu, which was, you know, the food of the people along with my fate, basically. He left him with that when he, quote-unquote, died. Mm-hmm. And really, all that he wants is to know what he really is. And isn't that the most natural thing in the world? Jiro died because it was fate. God illuminated the future for me. Actually, no. I am God. And Toriko, very unimpressed with this epic speech, just grabs him by what would be his collar, but he's not wearing clothes. He just has sagging bits of flesh. So he just grabs him by this huge lump of flesh, and Toriko just says, you're saying complete nonsense. You are a complete egoist, and anyway, you're talking about fate and how we can't do anything, but we walk of our own volition, and the anger I feel right now isn't because of my appetite. It's the trembling of my soul.
Pretty cool speech for him, actually.
Yeah, it's a cool little line. And Acacia is equally unimpressed. He says, "I am the gourmet god, and you ought to think of what you're doing right now as grabbing the collar of the entire world, if not the entire cosmos." And Turka says, "Nah, I'm just grabbing onto some gross B-class gourmet hunter."
Aww, like Niazai starts crying, like, "You have to tell it like it is!"
And Coco jumps in and is like, "Well, the atmosphere here is pretty toxic."
I was like, "You didn't actually fucking do that, did he?"
I'm sorry. I was just like, Coco, like, at the end of all these trading bars back and forth, is like, "And now I will say the final line."
He's like, "Hey, that was quite a poisonous exchange." I'm like,
"That doesn't make any sense, Coco. Shut the fuck up.
Make sure that you don't.
There's no need for you to spew so much venom." God damn it.
I hope that this doesn't cyanide our relationship. They're like, what?
What does that mean?
Poison.
Poison. Oh, God. But, Acacia says, "Who do you think you are?" And Coco says, "He's Toriko. Toriko, who is one of the 4 gourmet hunter kings. It's no longer your era, Acacia." And Acacia apparently has finally just gotten completely bored of all this, because he just leans his head back and screams out, "Joey, are you done yet? You know, that's, I was kind of doing this to buy you time, you know."
Fuck, goddamn. I didn't know I had to shout it out to you.
But Joey says, "I've actually been launching germs to attack them this whole time, but it seems that they've actually had countermeasure against my germs this whole time." And Toriko says, "Nah, yeah, because we've got a germ user on our side." And Akisha has actually finally gotten frustrated with him by saying, "Oh, you guys are so full of hope. Guys like you taste awful when I eat them, and that Nitro I ate earlier was like that too. He never lost hope even on death's doorstep. Why was that?" And Toriko says, "Because at the end he told us the method to prepare God." And sure enough, as you indicated suspicion for at the in the last chapter, when as he was being eaten, all he was actually caring about was conveying them how to prepare God. And somehow he managed to do this via scent for Toriko, sound for Zebra, electromagnetic waves through Coco,
and through bullshit for half of them.
Right. It's like, he could have just whispered it and Zebra could have told them, but whatever. But yeah. So, anyhow, we then kind of cut away to the some of the Blue Nitro, were, you know, talking to each other, the last, you know, alive ones, anyway. And one of them says that, you know, Center is on its way here, and soon it will all be over. And Acacia, by the way, I should point out, there have been a few times where he's opened his mouth. He's got three tongues. Very creepy.
Yeah, he has a lot of things in his mouth that just shouldn't be there. It's pretty gross and disturbing.
But he vows to turn all of their hope into despair, because that's the only way that it'll taste good when he eats them. He demands that they show, you know, him their faces twisted in pain and so on and so forth. Coco then steps forward and is like, "Leave this one to me, Toriko." And Joey's like, "Who the fuck do you think you are?"
"Who the fuck are you?"
And then shapes start to emerge from this black mass behind them. I don't know exactly what they are, but anyhow. Then she, like, just looks over her shoulder towards God and says, "We're going to repair you now," but God is suddenly not looking very good. Kind of making a face.
Yeah.
At the end of the chapter.
Some people are saying maybe he's already being prepared, like Komatsu just knows how to do it, and the other guy's helping him. I like to think that it's just like it has indigestion from eating the moon. It just like has like a really loud fart that just destroys half of the planet.
And then it turns into a capybara.
Yeah, everyone's like, "Well, this is sort of weird." But this all did make sense by the end of it, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Overall, really like this chapter. Lots of really cool lines between both our hero and villain, and it's just a talking chapter, but it's a really heated exchange that they have as their ideals clash off one another.
Yeah,
I like how, you know, Acacia gives his big, "I'm just trying to find who I am. Isn't that perfectly natural?" Turk is just like, "You're full of shit.
Fuck you. You ate my friend,
who was kind of your son. What the fuck?"
He's like, "Well, you know, you can't.
It's good.
Yeah." If he didn't want to be eaten, he shouldn't have been so delicious.
I mean, technically, I didn't eat him. I just, you know, made his body explode. But yeah. Whatever.
I told him when he was a kid, "If you don't want me to eat you, don't be so damn delicious." I thought he would have taken that advice. He didn't.
It's really, you know what? I did my best as a father, but some bad apples you just can't raise right.
Sometimes you just have to eat your kids.
Animals do it all the time.
So. Yeah. Not any of the friendly ones, just the monstrous ones. They do it a lot.
Alright, let's wrap things up with World Trigger, Chapter 144, Yoko Katori.
The much, much longly awaited Katori flashback chapter, Dick. Finally, we will
You were waiting for it last week.
No, because we've kind of thought, like, we were going to get an explanation to why she is the way she is, and we're going to find out who she is. And finally, get some much-needed insight to show us that she's not actually a bad person deep down. Truly, this flashback will go to show that she is the sympathetic one in all of this situation. Surely, the chapter's named after her. Surely she won't come off looking worse than she already did.
So the flashback goes to months before the first neighbor invasion, to when Katori and operator Hana, that's her name, right, Hana?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually knew each other when they were a little bit younger. Because this would have to be like, what, like a year and a half, 2.5 years ago or something like that? Because it's before the first neighbor invasion. But basically it just shows, you know, it's like they're hanging out at Katori's place. Katori's playing a video game and Hana is kind of like backseat gaming her. She's like, you know, you don't have a lot of protective gear, so maybe just like leveling up isn't going to work out so well. And he's like, I don't need protective gear. My intuition is good enough for me to win because I'm bullshit perfect at everything that I do until I encounter difficulties, and then I just throw the controller away because fuck this game.
Yeah, amusingly, she's playing Dark Side too, I've been told. So apparently, she's playing a game that's frustrating to no end, and she's like, I'm just going to wing it.
Like Dark Souls?
Yeah, the original Dark Souls, I think, is what people are saying she's playing.
She's fucking dead. Katori's mom also came in and was like, you know, come on, spend time with your friend Hana here. And she's like, well, you know, I'm just here to take a break from studying and so on and so forth. And they basically just set them up as complete opposites. You know, Hana is a very studious girl, and Katori is just kind of like, oh, I never have to study. I always get good grades. Which, I mean, we basically don't learn very much about Katori's traits in this chapter, but it sets her up in contrast with Hana, who ends up being a much more important character than I think we initially expected.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of stuff, like, Hana's parents also come over to their house at one point, and their father says, my daughter's not going to be visiting anymore. You should understand it's counterproductive for both girls to just let them play around during this important period in their lives. Why should children be allowed to have fun?
Now, it's weird, because for the longest time, I kept thinking this was somebody from the series, but as we'll find out, he doesn't hang around, so I don't know why. He reminds me of someone from the series, though, definitely, like one of the border executives.
After he walks outside, after delivering that ultimatum, her mother stuck around to say, I'm sorry he's acting that way. He's just upset because Hana didn't rank number one in her cram school tests. And if she gets first place in the next one, he'll probably change his mind, so don't worry about this. It has nothing to do with you, it just has to do with, you know, that. And Katori responds to this news by going, what the heck was that? It pisses me off. Anyway, but,
this girl!
We do get this cool moment where, Hana is studying in her room, and then she looks up, and, because they're next-door neighbors, actually, not just friends, Katori's father, cuts out a hole in the wall, and opens it up, and makes this new window, and, Hana's like, what are you doing? Well, you know, it's because Yoko kept on crying about not being able to see you. He's like, that's no shit, dude! I hate you!
God, Dad, you're embarrassing me! Yeah. From this person I tolerate!
And it looks as though Katori's got an older brother, I guess? I guess that's a brother.
I don't know if he's older.
Well, a brother. Yeah. And I think he is older, considering the height and... But anyhow... But he's like, oh yeah, you know, and also this was used to be my room, and we're switching. So, yeah, pretty much went out of her way to get into situations so that they could still see each other without kind of being allowed to technically come over.
Yeah.
And Gory's just like, just did it because I felt like it.
Yeah, I did it because it's me. Shut up.
They have a conversation later on where Katori is still playing by herself, Hana is still studying, hard at work, and Hana says, you know, I study on my own, I learned that the world radically changes its shape every few years or decades. Even if I follow my parents' instructions, that may not be how things work by the time I grow up. That's why I'm also working on my own, so I won't get panicked when things go that way. So I won't have to blame them if it turns out my parents were wrong in the future. And as it turns out, he was pretty right. Probably not in the way that she expected to be.
Yeah.
The day of the neighbor invasion occurs, And Katori kind of misses it, because she's sleeping in when it happens, and her house collapses on her.
Yes.
She wakes up, and the first sight that she sees is Hana digging her out of the rubble. And she moves, you know, some wood around, and she's, you know, kind of bleeding from the head a little bit, and she reaches out and pulls her up out of the wreckage. And Katori's like, what's happening? Because she's, you know, just looking out and seeing that their entire neighborhood is in complete ruins, while there are various neighbors in the background still rampaging around. And Hana just says, we've got to run, let's go. And Katori looks over, and she's like, my family, what's going on? And Hana just picks her up, puts her around her shoulders, and says, it's going to be all right. And they move and, you know, get to safety. And it turns out Katori's family, or at least, well, let's see, is the rest of her family there? Yeah, they're fine.
Yeah, you
all,
see
her entire family is fine. They all made it to safety while Katori presumably was asleep. Because there is a moment, like, where, you know, Katori refuses to get up because it's, like, Sunday, she wants to sleep in. Presumably that's why she didn't evacuate, I guess.
Well, it's even more kind of terrifying, too, or a little harrowing, I guess, is for a brief moment, Katori looks at Hana's hand and sees that it is mad, like, it's missing a couple nails, and the other ones that are still there are kind of, like, hanging off. It's just kind of, like, bloody nubs all the way around. So it isn't just that she, you know, survived. She clearly had to do some things to escape, too. Mm-hmm. And has been, I presumably, just been destroying her hands in the process.
Well, presumably it's because she's just been digging Katori out by hand.
Yeah.
The whole time. And so after Katori gets the news that, you know, all of her family is safe, you know, her mom then says, you know, we were getting ready to leave, so we were saved, but Hana's family wasn't. And so Katori goes to see Hana in the hospital, and she's recovering, and she's like, why did you save me instead of your own family? And Hana says, because the roof on your house looked lighter than ours. I only chose who was more likely to survive, so don't worry about it. And it's like,
Jesus. And I'm like, Nick, what was the name of this chapter again? It's Hana something part one, right?
Right. Then we cut to later on, as Hana has been released from the hospital, and so Katori's talking with her, and she says, oh, you decided to go to the junior high Mikado? Well, you know, I thought that you would go to a better school outside the prefecture, you know, with your grades. And Hana says, well, you know, I've been thinking, once I'm less busy with school, that I would join Border. And, you know, if you become a regular member, they pay you, and so I heard they even will provide you with housing in the base. And Katori's like, okay, I'll come with you. And Hana says, well, okay, but if you come with me, I'm going to be aiming for the top. And Katori says, it's going to be easy. I'm a genius.
Yeah, don't worry. I got this.
We'll be unstoppable. And then the flashback ends, and her internal thought is, like, you know, these guys acting like they're the freaking heroes. Like, I'm Titus, and this is my story, you know? And that's where the moment that we left off at the end of the last chapter. I do really like this chapter because of what it does for Hana.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, I love this chapter. Like,
and honestly, the whole title of being Katori, I think that that's kind of the point. Like, because this isn't Katori's story. Even
she hasn't had
story,
to struggle. She hasn't had to endure any loss. Everyone else has done it for her, and she's just been the talented one.
Even her own story is not her story. It's Hana's.
Yeah.
So, I really like that. And, I mean, yeah, she has, you know, been through some amount of struggle. Like, she did have her house freaking collapse on her. But what's she actually been through? You know, like, her house was destroyed, sure. But her whole family survived. She didn't go through any real personal trauma. She slept through the invasion. Whereas Hana worked really hard, saved her life, tore up her hands in the process, had her own family killed by her own decision. Jesus.
Yeah, like, it's just like, it's a great chapter for Hana, because immediately I'm like, I've never cared more about an operator in this series. Far and away, you're the most, like, sympathetic character not in like Tamakoma 2 to me at this point. Like, you, that's a, like, well-developed character who suddenly I'm like, I see a lot of tragedy in you, and I wish you only the best. And that said, I'm looking at Katori, and I'm like, you're still a bitch! This story didn't make you look any better! You're still lazy shit! And I, you know, it's the, maybe that payoff or anything like that. But I'm certainly at the end of the chapter, not like, you go, Katori, you show those two. I'm at the end of the end of the chapter, I'm like, Osamu, please kill her immediately! And maybe this time, when she loses to a fucking goober like you, no offense, but she loses to you, she'll get her shit together. That's my hope.
I do really like it, though, where she's like, you know, she's like, goes through this flashback, and she's like, you know, this is my story. I'm gonna, you know, protect people like that. And it's just like, no, that's proof that this isn't your story. You're the side character.
Yeah.
It's really cool. I really appreciate that. So I really like this chapter. It was not my favorite this week, but did really enjoy it. And I liked it more, actually, now that we've talked about it some more, too. That's going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. So let's choose our favorite chapters and our MVPs.
This was a tough week. Because there really wasn't, like, one chapter that stood out to me in any way. There are a couple chapters that I didn't think were too great, and then there are some that were, like, kind of okay. So I'm going with one here that I'm not like, what an amazing chapter, but of the group, I probably like it the best, and that'd be World Trigger. I enjoyed that flashback a lot. It was, you know, compelling. It gave some good, you know, motivation to some of these characters, so I'm able to get into it completely off of that.
I get you. And my favorite is My Hero Academia. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it as much as last week's chapter, but it was not up against very stiff competition this week. I think that it's... for me, it was between that and World Trigger, and I like the one for My Hero Academia just a little bit more. It's a little... because it's got the action and it's got the character moments in it, whereas World Trigger just has the character building in it.
Yeah.
My MVP is going to be Acacia.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I can see that.
I really like just a lot of the stuff he had to say. Again, continuing to build him as this complete asshole villain. He's got some really badass lines in this one, but also I just like how he has this, you know, whole kind of sob story to him, but immediately his thing addresses with, you're just being a total dickhead, you know. He's allowed to have that story, but then put in the context of, no, he is obviously delusional and, you know, psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I do completely dig it. My character of the week then is Hana. She won that chapter over for me completely, so I'm absolutely happy with giving it to her.
She was also my runner-up for the character.
Yeah.
I thought pretty strongly about doing it, but, our audience chose My Hero Academia this week. A couple of good chapters, but honestly, like, I think it's one of the weaker weeks we've had recently. It wasn't bad, but it was just like there wasn't a whole lot that stood out this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing bad or anything like that, to just stress that. Just
aside from Asta.
Nick's words, not mine. Please don't hit me, Alisa. We can still be friends, right?
I do not endorse anything that...
Yeah, that's the opinions of this dude over here. He's saying crazy things.
Nick's opinions do not reflect the opinions held by the Weekly Manga Recap podcast.
Yeah, at least this half over here. Like, it's going to be like a fucking 80s sitcom. Like, I just take a streak of paint, paint it down. I'm like, you keep your opinions on that side. I'll keep my good ones on this side.
That's going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. This week, we record the show on hitbox.tv/RealOT Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time normally, but sometimes we do need to change things up. So to stay updated, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow at WMR Podcast for up-to-date, specifically podcast-relevant stuff. And you can also follow us individually. He's at RealOT, and I'm at YRulerOfTime. Be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, also on our YouTube page. And, of course, on iTunes, where you can leave a comment or rating to help us beat the Woodworking Podcast assholes. Also, be sure to send us criticism, ask us questions, suggest future manga for us to read by emailing them to us. weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is the place to do it. We go through all that. And also, for those of you who have said, by the way, in the past, I am worried about that I'm emailing you too much. Don't worry about it. Seriously. We appreciate all the feedback we get.
Nah, it's all good. I wouldn't worry about too much, anybody. By the way, in regards to our Patreon, in case you missed it, the bonus pod for April came out. We got the roast pod out there, so if you're a $5 patron and you want to pick that up, you can grab it on there now. And if you were one last month in April and you aren't now, just let us know through the email and we'll get you that pod. And I actually, just before the episode came up, put up the May bonus pod, which is our top 10 manga fights. Nick and I did it last night. And we had a pretty good discussion on that. So if you want to check that one out, $5 patron, again, you can grab it on the Patreon right now.
I also really pissed Chris off a couple of times.
It's infuriating. There was like a coin flip, essentially, to decide who got to make picks first, and Nick did it. And even though his list wasn't in order, he found a way to just undercut half my picks.
Like, Chris had his whole, his thing, like, laid out from, you know, from bottom to top, and I was just like, I don't have an order for these, so I'm just gonna roll dice to see what comes up. And I spoil like his top two in like my first three.
It was mind blowing at points. It really felt intentional by the end.
Special thanks go out, by the way, to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy.
Yes. Special thanks, by the way, go out to Mitch Parker and Walker Brown, who are our newest patrons. Thank you very much, both of you. It is greatly appreciated.
And finally, special thanks go out to the people who help out with the podcast. Steve Mann, our talk artist. You can check out his work in therockfanboy.deviantart.com. He's got his own Patreon. He's on Tumblr in a few places. He does awesome work for us. Thank you very much. And, of course, the infamous Planet, friend of the podcast, whenever I'm not adding the to the beginning of his name and, you know, dragging him for being British. Do we have a suggestion for next...
Oh my god, yes, I do have a suggestion. This is one that most recently was sent to us by Blake Schwartz, but I know a lot of people have been recommending this one for a while, so I figure this would be a good mood change after the fun, happy adventures of Pokemon. We read a series about bullying, Nick. So we're going to be taking a look at a series called The Silent Voice, which is a series Crunchyroll has, and it's about disability and bullying. By like a young kid who kind of bullies a girl, and then, you know, just because he's bored, and then realizes what he's doing and kind of grows and learns from it. I basically had to do this because they listened to our roast podcast and they thought we were being really mean on it. So this is kind of necessary for people to be like, look, Channel Awesome and YouTube came together to this, finally bridged the gaps, and they're like, you gotta tell these guys to take a fucking bullying class. So. That is what we'll be doing.
There's a baby metal song that is perfect for this too.
that's like, oh, we play next week while we're doing the entire sad story of the girl
just
being bullied. Yeah.
Just sit it on loop.
There was a part of me that wanted that Pokemon music playing on a loop as we talked about. I was like, one, it's gonna get annoying, two, god damn it, I know Nintendo will get pissed about that. So yeah, that's what we're gonna be doing next time, and I don't know. What do we say before we get on out of here?
There's a fly buzzing around here. I'm going to kill it and eat it.
You started with just eat it, and I got really concerned there. But do you think maybe you should get like tacos instead?
I am pretty hungry.
I am very hungry as well. Let's stop doing this. Go get food.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, bye.